Broadcasting through our flagship station, KNYE, in Pahrump, Nevada, and worldwide on the internet, this is Midnight in the Desert. I am your host, Tim Weisberg. Whether it is the brightest of day or the darkest of night, wherever you may be, it's time to settle down for the next 3 hours as we enter into a world of wonder and weird that you won't hear anywhere else. And we are ready for another full week packed full of amazing shows for you. And we're going to get things started off tonight with, well, we're going to be talking about some strange, offbeat, and bizarre tales with our guest, Robert W. Bly. And so we're just going to have some fun tonight. I think that that's a great way to wind down a holiday. I'm sure a lot of you have the chance to observe today as a holiday, being President's Day. And that makes for a good, a good kind of transition and back into the work week, is to just kind of let our hair down and talk about some fun stuff, which is what we'll do tonight. Speaking of fun stuff, last week we had Twin Peaks Week. And for those of you who are still wondering about who won the grand prize of the contest, well, I was convinced to push off the drawing about another 24 hours. Some folks emailed me. They said, hey, I listened to the show at work. I haven't had a chance yet to listen to the archive show. Can you give us one more day to be able to enter? And I said, you know, I'm trying to be as fair to everybody, trying to make it as accessible to everybody. So let's do that. We'll wait until tomorrow to draw the winner of the grand prize of the Twin Peaks Week contest, that being two silver package tickets to Twin Peaks 30 at Graceland, happening April 5th through the 7th. You can get your tickets if you want by going to graceland.com/Twin Peaks. But if you want to win those tickets, all you have to do is take all five code phrases from last week, you know, nothing crazy, just a couple of words each, have them all written down, have them all saved, and then go either into the wormhole at midnightinthedesert.com for all of you time travelers out there and submit them via the wormhole, or email me, tim@midnightinthedesert.com, with all five code phrases. I'm going to take everybody that gives me the correct phrases. I'm going to enter their name into a random name generator, and then we'll select the winner of the grand prize of the Twin Peaks 30 silver package tickets. Now, I ask that you don't enter if you can't use them. If you're not going to be able to fly yourself to Memphis, if you're not going to be able to stay in Memphis over the weekend, you know, please don't try to enter the contest. We'd hate to have you win these tickets and then not be able to use them. But anybody that can use them and wants to enter. Now, you don't have to be a time traveler to win, but you may need to be a time traveler to go back and get those code phrases. So if you missed any of them during the course of the week, just go to midnightinthedesert.com, sign up, become a time traveler, get access to the archives, and that will give you the chance to find all five code phrases, write them all down, and be able to submit them to win the prize. So if you look at it like this, it's a really small investment, just $4.99, to maybe win a prize package worth $800. So we'll try and draw that tomorrow night. We'll just make sure that we give everybody a fair shake at being able to enter the contest. Well, let's get right into tonight's conversation. Robert W. Bly is an independent copywriter and marketing consultant, as well as the author of over 100 books. His articles have appeared in Cosmopolitan, City Paper, Parent Paper, New Jersey Monthly, and many other publications. He has been an avid science fiction, fantasy, and horror fan since the 1950s. He holds a BS in chemical engineering from the University of Rochester and is a member of the American Institute of Chemical Engineers. And he joins us on the line tonight. Good evening, sir. How are you?
Great, Tim. How are you?
Doing very well. And I think that it's very important that when we talk about things like science fiction, we have to tell people we're going to get as weird as we can tonight. That's the way that we like it here on Midnight in the Desert.
Well, that's always been my leaning too in it, and I'm ready to do it.
So now it says in your bio that you've been a fan of science fiction, fantasy, and horror since the 1950s. Was it finding novels? Was it some of the comic books of the day? What was it that got you interested in this topic?
Well, back in the 50s, I was very young, but I read early, and I got into I started with the comic books. The classics. There was, for example, Frankenstein. When I got, into older, where I was in elementary school, then I began to read actual books, and I read the science fiction magazines, the short stories. And then in 1964, my parents bought a color TV, and I turned it on, and there was Star Trek in color. It was the first show I'd ever seen in color, and I was blown away and hooked for life.
Well, I think that's what happens for a lot of us, is it's not something that we dabble in if we have an interest in this. It kind of becomes all consuming to some degree.
It is. Yeah. I love pop culture in general, but I focus, my interest is in science fiction. And with my, like a lot of science fiction fans and writers, I have a STEM, a background. I'm a chemical engineer. So, it's a good fit for me all around. I was always fascinated by the science first, and then as I got older, I shifted more to the stories and the bizarre and the fantastic.
I mean, that was a great time too. That era, and even through today, we've had some great strides made in that type of storytelling. But in the 1950s, 60s, those days, there was some really great content coming out and some really prolific writers that I don't know if we still see the same market for some of that today. I think maybe things have become more niche today. So it's harder to say that, but it seems like some of the most prolific writers of the time were science fiction and fantasy writers.
What's interesting is that there is not that market today for science fiction, but the fantasy market is bigger and the books are selling more than ever. So, fantasy won out, and horror is probably second, and science fiction lags behind with third. There's still a lot of science fiction books, but the magazine field has shrunk. And, people today overall, as I see, don't read short stories as much as they do novels.
Well, that's true. And if you look at what's popular and what's, kind of in the public eye, it's things like the Game of Thrones books, the Harry Potter books, things like that are what are keeping people reading books more so than just watching them on television or in the movies. They're wanting those complete stories, so they're going back and they're finding the novels that they were based on.
Absolutely, and one could make the argument that J.K. Rowling single-handedly reinvigorated reading in children, and I think that's true.
Yeah, it's not a stretch to say that. And what's interesting about it is the people that I know that were kids when Harry Potter came about, like my siblings, my sister-in-law and everything, they were kids who got Harry Potter books and then have never put down a book since. They're always reading something, and it doesn't always have to be something from the fantasy realm. They've just developed that love of reading, and I don't know that there's anything else that would have kept them reading at that same level.
I agree. In my case, a child of the 50s and 60s, the first book series I got into, well, there's two. One was the Foundation series by Asimov, and then even more so, when I was in junior high school, we all were addicted to and read every book in The Lord of the Rings, including The Hobbit.
But you also mentioned that the publishing industry, the magazine publishing industry, is shrinking, and that's got to be a sharp blow to some of the topics that you like to write about. Because for a lot of people, that's how they got introduced to a lot of these stories. It was through the short story format, through the stories appearing in magazines. It's a lot harder to convince somebody to go out and buy a full book of something that they might only have a casual interest in than to give them a magazine or an anthology where they'd get a whole bunch of those.
It is, although thankfully the magazine of fantasy and science fiction is still going strong. They publish a thick book, a big magazine, and so they're healthy, and they must be healthy in their financial position, and I don't see them coming to an end anytime soon.
Now, it may not be necessarily helpful for those who want to make a living at writing these type of stories, but at least in terms of getting eyeballs on them, I'm sure the internet has helped in the fact that you can bring like-minded people together and create these sites or go to these sites where content is being created and being shared and critiqued. So while it may not necessarily translate into, publishing dollars, at least it's keeping the storytelling format alive.
Yes, and there's sites that publish fan fiction, and you could just say amateur fiction that they don't pay, but you can get an audience. And you can do that in other ways. People are getting audiences by doing shows on YouTube. So, yeah, there are opportunities there. And I think overall the Internet has been good for readers and literacy, whether it remains to be good for writers, although I think it is, that has to be determined. I did have, until his passing recently, a collegial or friendly relationship with Harlan Ellison, and as you know, he was very against what the internet did, the practice of posting stories without pay. In fact, one of the things that irked him and ranked him, which I don't think most people agree with, that he thought anyone who would write without pay was ruining the market for professionals. But that was his opinion, and you know, he was passionate about it, but I don't think that's the majority opinion.
Well, you had mentioned fan fiction, and I know that is it's a hot button issue with a lot of writers, because fan fiction is great because it allows you to explore different theories and ideas, and everybody kind of understands it for what it is. But then you also have those who get upset because somebody is taking your intellectual property and using it in a way that you don't have any control over. So, I look at that as being, a great tribute to a lot of the cat. I don't know why there's so much ire from people who look at fan fiction and say, you're bastardizing my stories.
Well, some publishers and writers openly encouraged it. I mean, the most obvious example is August Derleth and his publication of H.P. Lovecraft. The people who own that material now, they openly encourage people to write stories in, the Lovecraft mythos. But yes, there are, and I've been exposed to this. I had I wrote a nonfiction science fiction book. It was a trivia book, and one of the owners of the intellectual property, a big movie studio, said to me essentially, cease and desist. So I don't know why they object to it. I certainly wouldn't object to it if I was a best-selling famous fantasy or science fiction author. Roger Zelazny encouraged it, for example, but a lot of people do object to it, and the courts legally say that, the holder of the intellectual property is correct. They have control.
Cough once if it was Star Trek, twice if it was Marvel. No, I'm just kidding. You don't
know. That would actually get me in legal trouble because they got me in a room, and I thought I was right in the case. And my attorney said, you may be right, but what's your budget for me versus their budget for their lawyers?
Right.
Don't fight it. You just give up before they ruin you financially. So I had to give.
Totally understandable. But, then you look at an organization like, I guess it probably started with Lucasfilm because I think it goes back before the Disney acquisition. But the world of Star Wars actually not only encourages, these fan-made films, but they also hold a competition each year for the best fan-made film. So while they may not necessarily like all of the fan fiction that's written, they do like when fans put some effort into kind of continuing some of the mythologies, or at least playing in the universe of Star Wars.
Yeah, and that's true in other universes too. There is some excellent fan fiction on YouTube for Batman where these movies – they look just about as good as the real or authorized Batman movies. They're fantastic.
Well, that's an easy one though, because you don't have to have all the CGI, superpowers. You just have to be able to fight.
One of them though has Batman fighting predators from the movie Predators.
And
that took some special effects, whether it was CGI or costume. I think it was CGI, and that was pretty fantastic.
So in just kind of doing more of a general overview, a general flyover of today's world of science fiction, it's got to be at this point in time where it's got to be really challenging to try to come up with really out there concepts. You have to kind of work, I would guess, more in the world of what we already know, because everything that was science fiction at the time that you started reading these stories has now become reality. We're just short of flying cars. And once we're there, I think we've covered pretty much everything. That all now when you're working in the realm of science fiction, is it hard to come up with envisioning a future now based on the fact that the future has become the present so quickly.
Interestingly, this idea of science fact becoming, you know, science fiction and vice versa, I wrote a book on that, and it was published from science fact to science fiction. But I don't think it is difficult to come up with new ideas. You know, Ray Bradbury said there'll never be a shortage of ideas because each of us has a unique life, a unique experience that no one else has. So, yes, you take standard ideas, i.e. time travel, but your own imagination twists it in a way that no other writer would think of or has thought of.
So even though, you know, some of the concepts and the tropes may be the same, everybody's going to have their own different applications for it.
That's exactly right. And people, while the applications, yes, may be based on other formats and other plots, the variations are tremendous. And so you can never run out of ideas for science fiction and fantasy.
Do you think that the next generation of science fiction, fantasy, horror writers, do you think that they're coming up from this internet age of, you know, sharing some of these stories? I mean, if you look at a guy like Joe Hill, I mean, kind of got a little bit of a inside look at how this all works growing up, but he's also a guy that has done very well in leveraging the internet to help him with his storytelling and to help him build a base for his stories. And it seems like that is the new route for a lot of people to become popular writers is, you know, get the stuff out there, be prolific on the internet, and then it makes it easier to get the book deal.
It actually is, and that happens more and more today. And also, you're right, the younger generation, or even people just who are living, you could be older, but just enthusiastic about the internet, as I am, for example, rather than view it as an adversary, you know, we view it as a platform where, yeah, you can get a broader audience, and that can eventually lead to a book deal. And it's happened many times.
And it's funny because we need to have that fresh spate of ideas, because a lot of movies that are coming out are really, there's a lot of reboots, a lot of rehashes, a lot of unnecessary sequels. And one of the few places where you can find new original content is in the world of fantasy and science fiction. You know, that seems to be something that there's always, you know, new movies coming out that push that. And those are quite often based on the books that have been pushing those same themes.
Yeah, absolutely. And the what's interesting is, to me, one subgenre of science fiction that I particularly like is superheroes, comic books. And, you know, they were floundering for many years, but ever since Superman 1, they began making high-quality Marvel and DC movies, and that has caused a huge resurgence in people buying not only comic books, but superhero books. You know, a lot of them are trade paperbacks, which are generally compilations of, you know, series in the comic book. So the movies have been very good for the comic book industry.
And I'm sure we'll dive deeper into superheroes as we go along tonight. But what I've noticed is that, you know, when I was younger, I was a comic book collector growing up in the 80s and in the 90s. And it was getting to be a little bit more popular then, because it went through a little bit of a boom, especially in the early 90s. But at the same time, it wasn't something that people openly talked about. And if there were comic conventions happening around me, I certainly didn't know about them unless I read about them in the back of a Marvel mag. You know, these days, it's completely changed, because the comic book stories, the superhero characters, the comic cons, it's all gone completely and totally mainstream.
Not only has it gone mainstream, but I had my best friend from college for decades worked at DC. And he told me maybe 5 or 10 years ago, he said, "We're making the most sales of the books, not the individual comics, but the, you know, the paperback collections that you would find on the shelves of Barnes & Noble from adults. They finally feel it's legitimate to take one of these, bring it up to a bookstore clerk, and not only not feel embarrassed, but be proud, because the clerk reads the same thing and you have something to discuss. So the movies have helped legitimize and make mainstream superhero fiction and comic books.
Yeah, I mean, I remember buying the Nightfall novelization and the Death and Life of Superman novelization, you know, buying those in the local bookstore and maybe buying the only copy that they had on the shelf. You know, now you see books like that and there's multiple copies and there's people hanging around in that section reading those books. And it's made a difference because, like you said, the same way Harry Potter brought a lot of these kids into reading books, the superheroes are a gateway for, I think, this generation to start getting into reading novels.
I agree with it. And as you point out, there have been a number of novelizations of the major superheroes. I think there's a publisher who I haven't read them, but has a whole series of original paperback novels about Wolverine, and there's been a number of novels about Superman and Batman, and they're good. I've read a lot of them.
And I always like them because they give you the story comes in a little bit deeper, as deep as the storytelling can get in comic books, and it can in the best of the books. But the more that you get deeper into the novels, you can get deeper into the characterizations. You don't have to rely on the artist's vision of what it is that you're seeing. And it really kind of expands the story. Because I read, you know, the Nightfall series of comics. I read the Death and Life of Superman comic series. I collected them all. You know, I waited in line to get my black bag version of the Death of Superman. But when you read these novels, you realize that these aren't just surface level characters. These are deep, complex, fictional beings that exist in their own fictional universe that you can dive into head on.
Absolutely, and that's not always the case on TV, but sometimes it is. For years, I never did it, but for years I thought about, what about doing a novel that is the history of Krypton? And sure enough, they came out with CW, I think, last year, with the Krypton show. So, you know, it goes on, and it brings it to a broader audience.
And I think we've kind of reached the pinnacle point of where we can take superhero storytelling, when now we've even had a superhero horror movie with Brightburn last year, which I thought was genius.
I just loved Brightburn. I also thought it was genius. I was mesmerized by it.
Because all it really is it's just a different filter of looking at the exact same story of Superman, but it's just a different twist, and it's just if something had gone slightly the other way, you know, he could have been the destructor of the planet instead of the savior.
Well, it goes to exactly what we were discussing, saying, well, everything's been done, so where do you find new ideas? Well, the idea of an alien coming to Earth and as a baby and having superpowers had done, but the twist that whoever wrote Brightburn did is said, well, what if he had been bad instead of good? And also there was a comic book where it ended up that the infant's cat spaceship from Krypton, instead of crashing in the United States, crashed in the Soviet Union, and it became their superhero.
Yeah, so that's what I love about it, is especially now in DC more than anything, is creating these alternate universes and these alternate characters, and the way of saying, like, listen, we've been telling you these stories for, you know, 50, 60, 70 years now, but we're willing to shake that up, and we're willing to go in some different directions and play the what if game.
Yeah, and with the popular concept and DC Comics and DC television hasn't hit the movies yet, is the multiverse. And it does open up a lot of possibilities, and it's supported by science. There are a number of theories that strongly support the possibility that, in fact, yes, there are multiple universes.
Well, we'll get into all of that and a whole bunch more, whereas we're going to be talking not only about some stories that our guest Robert W. Bly has written, but some of the science and the ideas behind those stories. And we'll talk some more about superheroes a little bit later on. We'll talk about some of the other big science fiction properties as well, at least as much as we can. And then we'll also take your questions. If you want to shoot your questions into the wormhole at midnightinthedesert.com, feel free to send them over in there, and we will ask the questions in there. And there's already some pouring in. You can also email me, tim@midnightinthedesert.com. But of course, the wormhole does get preference on the questions. So become a time traveler and you'll be able to send your questions through there. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll return as we talk more about tonight's topic, that being strange, offbeat, and bizarre tales with our guest Robert W. Bly when Midnight in the Desert returns in just a few moments. Welcome back to Midnight in the Desert. We are talking tonight with our guest Robert W. Bly about strange, offbeat, and bizarre tales. He is an author who has written, well, he's got this great book called Freak Show of the Gods, and we're going to be getting into some of the stories and the ideas behind those stories with him. And we'll also talk about all different kinds of things, all to do with science fiction, the world of superheroes, maybe even a little bit of the world of horror, all of that. Feel free to enter your questions into the wormhole at midnightinthedesert.com, or you can email me, tim@midnightinthedesert.com. Also, there's already some questions flying fast and furiously in the Midnight Society Facebook group, and we'll try and ask some of those as well. But I want to say that this is a question, Bob, that brought up some really warm memories for me when it was asked in the wormhole by Fred. He says one of his favorite science fiction magazines was Analog. There were always interesting stories. Have either of us read this publication before? And if so, any thoughts on its impact on any science fiction? And I would have to say, I remember picking up copies of Analog, not only at flea markets and yard sales and everywhere I could find them, but when I finally discovered, you know, the major bookstores, when the Barnes and Nobles and the Borders of the world started taking over, you know, and they started carrying Analog, I was like, well, that's, you know, that's a great reason to come here to buy all my magazines now. You didn't find that on the supermarket shelf.
Not at all. And you know, there were a handful of magazines, science fiction magazines, that were the leaders. And Analog, along with Magazine of Fantasy and Science Fiction, along with Galaxy, which is now no longer exists, along with more recently Isaac Asimov Science Fiction Magazine, was one of the leaders. And Analog had great, clean writing. It was lean toward hard science fiction. I think, I'm not sure, I think Ben Bova was the editor at one point. And they also had, which I liked, a monthly column that was a science article, or they'd run one or two science articles. And I had a friend who actually told me that way back when he wanted to be an Analog, he never sold a story there, but he sold nonfiction. So, yeah, Analog was terrific and very cleanly written, very well edited, and it was what you would call a fast read. The stories moved along.
When I was first doing this type of radio, I made friends with there's a number of, in my local area, there's a number of published horror authors. People who, you know, they're not, you know, Stephen King, but they've been working steadily and publishing horror stories and anthologies and publishing their own novellas. And, you know, these are names that people that are involved in the horror field will recognize. And I was talking with one of them and I said, what is it about the magazine format, the short story format that made the horror, the sci-fi genres so successful? And he said, you know what it was, is it was great editors. You had editors that would be in charge of these magazines or these anthology books that would make you a better writer. It wasn't just you submitting the story and them cleaning up the copy for print. They were really working with you to help you. They would take your initial draft and maybe help you develop the stories more. And so I'm sure you would agree that the editors played just as big of a part in some of these as the writers did.
Right. I mean, the dean of science fiction editors, John Campbell, who wrote one of his own stories, became the horror movie The Thing, which was recently remade. You read in Isaac Asimov's biographies about how Campbell worked so closely with Asimov and his other authors. In some cases, he was almost a co-author. Avram Davidson, a very good science fiction writer, I believe, was an editor of one of the magazines. And a lot of the editors, not all of them, but a lot of the editors have been, before they became the magazine editor, they were published science fiction novelists and authors.
Yeah, I mean, my day job is working as a digital editor, and I tell people all the time that, you know, now we're in such a stage of having to create and publish content so quickly that we don't have the same luxury that we have, you know, when you were a newspaper writer in the days pre-internet, you would submit a story. And although you were usually writing on deadline, if it was a big feature piece or if it was a big investigative series, you know, you'd have your editor over your shoulder the entire time, you know, somebody kind of working with you to help you develop that story. And in the internet age, we've lost a lot of that. But with, you know, short story storytelling and publications online, with fictional stories, like, you can still have that type of a relationship where you can grow as a writer. I mean, I wouldn't be the writer I am today had I not started off writing sports and having somebody over my shoulder telling me how to write sports because I didn't know what I was doing. You know, that's the way that you learn, is by somebody kind of holding your hand through the process. As much as natural talent is great, you know, it also helps to have somebody help direct and focus that talent.
I could not agree more. And sometimes I'm involved with, or I read debates of, should you publish both in fiction, science fiction, mainstream fiction, nonfiction? Should you self-publish or go to a traditional publisher? And the one thing, I have a newsletter, and people will tell me, well, why would you want to go to a mainstream publisher? Yeah, I self-publish and I could write anything I want. And I said, that's not a good thing. An editor is quality control for written communication. And working, I view it, you know, some writers dislike having an editor, and that's why they self-publish. I view an editor as a free added value-added service that my publisher is providing to me and helping me make every story, every chapter, every book better. So that's why my choice, I'm not saying it's the right choice, but my choice for my 100 books has always been to publish with a traditional publishing house. Because yeah, I get an editor, I get a proofreader.
Right, and they always give you a galley back to look over, so it's, you still have the final say, more or less, of what's going to get published, and you can see the changes that were made and understand how they're trying to make your storytelling better and how to make you a better writer for it.
Yeah, and that actually happens, as you know, even before the galleys, when you get your first draft of your manuscript back with what they call the first developmental edit. They make or suggest changes, and in the comments, and now that we have Word, in the comments section, they write an explanation of their thinking. So Word, the software, writing software, has enhanced the editing process, and you really not only see the change, but you understand the editor's logic. And most editors that I deal with today will say, make the change if you agree with it. If you question it, let me know. Email me, call me, and let's discuss.
I mean, no writer is perfect, and nobody is exempt, especially even from typos. And I try to instill upon my writers that you have to understand that even a typo, every typo that you have chips away at your credibility or chips away a little bit at how much the reader is willing to go down the journey with you. So if you have simple, sloppy mistakes that could have been easily corrected and they got by a second, third set of eyes, you know, that's going to turn off your reader. And it's almost like it's an insult to the reader that you didn't feel like you needed to present it to them in the best possible way.
Well, I write a lot, many nonfiction books. And if you have a typo there, they credit, you know, do you know what you're talking about? Because if you say the sun is 9.2 million miles from Earth instead of the correct number, 92 million miles, they think you're a boob, and they don't trust the rest of what you say. In fiction, it's almost worse because the typo, they glom on the typo. Their attention goes right to it, and it distracts them from the rest of the story, and they just keep thinking about that. I get, and I'm sure, I know other authors too, if a book of mine comes out and has a typo, there's a small legion of people who will fervently contact you and say, you know, how could this be? And it just bothers people. You know, maybe you might say out of proportion to what it is, but that's what it does. So typos are a harmful thing, both to stories and both to factual writing.
We put all of our stories up on Facebook, a lot of the new stories that we're writing and the opinion pieces that we're writing for my day job. And we'll put them up on Facebook and people will comment underneath it. Like comments that read something like, why you no have edit, take look at typo. You know, and I'm like, what? I don't even know what you're saying. And you're trying to accuse us of, you know, being less than credible because somebody typed a Y instead of an I.
What's also funny in that area is that people who write, whether they're writers or whoever, a lot of them hate having typos pointed out to them. And when you do it, they ignore you. I had I rented an office outside my home and worked there. And I would have lunch around the corner sometimes at a dinette. And one day I walked up to it and the sign, you know, they had paper signs in the window that says morning special Beacon, B-A-C-O-N and eggs. So I walked in and I was smiling. I said, you know, you misspelled it. It's bacon. I got the dirtiest looks. They didn't, you know, instead of changing, and they left the sign up for 3 days. People hate having their typos corrected.
No doubt. Well, the good thing is I'm sure we won't find any typos in Freak Show of the Gods. And if we did, we'd find out about it in the Amazon comments, I'm sure. But the, which, as you said, it only takes one thing for everybody to glom onto. But talk to us a little bit about the creation of this book. I mean, I just the title alone I love.
Well, the creation of the book is, I have a day job too. I'm a marketing copywriter, an advertising copywriter, and that's how I earn my living. My avocation is writing books, and of my 100 published books, really only two of them are fiction. So I have been writing, so I don't concentrate on that, but I love science fiction. I sold my first science fiction story when I was 16 or 17 to Galaxy Science Fiction magazine, and I've been writing science fiction at a very low volume and infrequently, but I've been doing it since then, so it's more than 40 years I've been doing it, and these are not all of the stories that I've written over that time, but, you know, of the couple of hundred, you know, I chose, you know, what I thought, and the publisher chose what we thought were the best 20 or 25, and what happened is you mentioned the Internet. I published a short electronic book that had maybe just a half a dozen of the stories, so people could get them, and I got a call from my editor at Quill Driver, that's a publisher of my nonfiction books, and said, we're doing fiction now. I actually found your book on Amazon. I never talked to him about it. He said, I read it. You got six stories here. Do you have 20 more? I said, yeah. He goes, give them to me. So I put them together in a manuscript, and I got a book contract a month later, and that led to my first book.
Well, I think that that's, you know, it's got to be rewarding, though, to know that when, hey, you've got this much, we want more. And that's got to be the best thing that any author of fiction can hear.
It's the best thing any author, period, can hear. I feel the same way when I do nonfiction books, even business books. I get this all the time. Someone will say, I have a book called The Copywriter's Handbook that teaches advertising copywriting. And it was first published in 85, and it's gone through several editions. And I got a call, you know, we had done a third edition, so I said, hey, we kept it current. And I got a call from someone complaining, I like this book, but it's out of date. I said, what do you mean we did a third edition? He goes, look at your copyright date. You did that 10 years ago. And so people, you know, the readers want updates. And in fact, I went to the publisher, and we have yet another fourth edition. And so much has changed in the world, and this affects both nonfiction and fiction, especially science fiction. So much changes that there, you know, you can always update and add to, and your readers, for both fiction and nonfiction, want that. They want to hear from you.
Well, and let's not forget that really great science fiction, and it doesn't have to be, but in a lot of cases, it's a reflection of society and a reflection of the times, and it's a bit of social commentary mixed in with fantastical stories.
It's either, I agree, it's either a bit of social commentary mixed in with fantastical or interesting science, or it's the same thing, but instead of social commentary, it's the emotion of the character. Something happens to someone, and this is Stephen King's specialty. There are a lot of, as you mentioned, there are a lot of horror writers who are very good, but he said his specialty is, first, I create some characters that you care about so much, you worry what happens to them, and then I make bad things happen.
Right. The one thing that's always irked me about Stephen King, and I don't know if it bothers other people as well, but I feel like his, you know, as much as he creates these fantastic characters that I get emotionally hooked with, and I want to go down the journey with them, but he's so terrible at creating names for these characters. That's got to be one of the hardest parts, is coming up with names that suit the character that you've created and that feel like, you know, they're organic names for these characters.
It sounds weird when you say it, but actually, and because you're a writer too, you know, it is actually difficult, easy to pick a name, but it's difficult to pick a name that fits without being obviously cornball or, you know, obviously symbolic. So yeah, name picking is difficult, and you know, some of his hit and some of his miss. But you know, the stories are, for me, are so good, not always and consistently, but more often than not, that I let that go.
Right, same here. Well, when you were putting together these stories, you know, what is your process? Do you, you know, like, as mentioning Stephen King, we've always heard that, you know, his kind of come to him in his nightmares, and that's kind of how he flushes this out. How does inspiration strike for you?
There is no standard method, but what happens is, because I'm not relying on science fiction as my main writing genre, you know, my main writing genre is marketing and then nonfiction books, I don't sit and try to come up with ideas, which gives me an advantage. You know, Stephen King and other, you know, and the horror writers you mentioned that you know in your area, to keep being prolific and productive, they say, I've got to come up with something. I just wait till an idea pops into my head. And, you know, sometimes that's often, and it can be triggered by different things, and sometimes it's very infrequent. Can I give you an example?
Sure.
So there is a story in my book called The Rubber Band Man, and people who have written to me or emailed me in response to the book, overwhelmingly that seems to be their favorite story. And essentially, you know, there was a scientific experiment in decades ago. Do you know the Uri Miller experiment, where they duplicated the ocean of early Earth? They put in the chemicals that they thought was there, and then they ran lightning through it to simulate the lightning that hit the ocean. And then in a week, they looked at it, and amino acids had formed, and components of DNA, not DNA, and because they were trying to figure out how did life form. And so and how did that translate to a story for me? In that office building where I worked, we had our mailboxes outside the office. There was a big metal stand and one of those multi-mailbox units where you'd go outside and get your mail. And I noticed that there was a huge collection of rubber bands under the box, because what happened is our mail came in rubber bands, so people would take their mail out, and instead of being neat and throwing it away in their garbage, they just take the rubber band off and drop it on the ground. And they were really piling up. Well, one day I heard a crack of thunder, and I looked out the window, and the tree on the lawn of the office building, very close to me, had been hit by lightning and had been fried. And it occurred to me, what if this conducted through the ground, like the Uri Miller experiment, and could it stimulate rubber bands? Because rubber bands are not artificial rubber. Most rubber is artificial. Rubber bands are made from organic rubber. And I said, what if it had the same effect as the Uri Miller experiment? And I also noticed simultaneously that it seems to me, at least, when I would look in my desk drawers, there was always tons of rubber bands, but I had always had trouble finding a paper clip. And I said, what if the rubber bands are eating the paper clips? And so that those elements went into that story called The Rubber Band Man, who comes upon this situation, discovers it with unfortunate results for him.
I like it, though, but it has just enough of that true life inspiration to it. And it doesn't sound like it's that fantastical. I mean, as much as it sounds like something we wouldn't want to have happen, you know, it's not hard to go down that road with you.
No, it's not. And again, the linchpin of that being credible was Uri Miller, where they actually did that. They ran miniature lightning bolts, electricity, to hit organic materials, and rubber bands are organic, and they had not created life, but they had created the early molecules of life. And to show that, you know, life could evolve from organic chemicals or materials. And so that, yeah, it was realistic. And I wasn't waiting for inspiration to strike, but lightning is what struck, and that's what gave me the story idea.
I love that. I just love it. I love when you know, for lack of a better term, the inspiration strikes when you least expect it. Because a part of that, too, is it just shows the imagination that goes into it, where you could sit there and read about a situation or find something on the internet and say, well, this sounds like it could be the good basis of a story. And then you have to sit there and think and try and plot out what could happen and then second guess some of the stuff that you've come up. It sounds like, you know, your process is just the story is put in front of you and you can kind of just see where it's going to go from there, as opposed to, is there a lot of, you know, starts and stops with you, or does it come out pretty much flowing straight from you?
The ideas come to my mind unbidden, and then I start writing them, and I generally, my stories are shorter rather than longer, you know, a few thousand words, and most often, if it's a short story length work, I'm also have a novella I'm working on, so that you can't do it as sitting. But if it's a short story, 2,000 words, 3,000 words, 4,000 words, I sometimes write it in one sitting. Now I go back, that's just a rough draft, and then I edit carefully and spend a lot more time on it. But often, yes, they come in one sitting. And other science fiction writers, much more well-known and much greater than I, including Asimov, have also, and I think Heinlein said it too, said when they got hit by an idea, I also think L. Ron Hubbard said it, for a short story, it would just come pouring, they said, pouring out of the typewriter, because they had typewriters, not computers. So yeah, when I get an idea that excites me, and it could be a short story or a short story, often, when I'm done with work that day, I'll stay in the office and just write, you know, till 2 a.m. or whatever.
I mean, again, we only have a couple minutes here before the break, so I don't want to get too deep into this. But the process of writing is different now, too, though, because when you were writing on a typewriter, you really didn't want to spend so much time, you know, with the corrective ribbon and going back and retyping and all that stuff. So you did put a little more thought to what you were typing onto the page, whereas now in the computer age, you literally can just let it pour out of you and then just a couple backspaces here and there or a highlight and delete here and there where necessary. So the editing, self-editing process as you're writing makes it so that you can allow for a lot more free-flowing story.
Yes. With the computer, what's great is you're reading your draft and you don't have to be afraid of finding an area where you know you have to fix it, or you should add or move, because in the old days you'd make a decision. You'd say, well, I could make the change, but that means I have to retype these two pages again, and it was a lot of work. And even getting rid of mistakes was using whiteout strips or, you know, horror of horrors, liquid whiteout. And, you know, with the computer, all that concern is eliminated, and you're less lazy about making changes because it's so easy. So in some ways, you could argue that it produces better writing. And I actually think that's true.
Yeah, I would agree. And I love the fact that, you know, as you're editing as you go, if you make changes, all of a sudden you don't have to now retype the four pages after that because you added in new ideas that popped into your head as you were typing it. So it's it does make it a lot easier. Although the downside of it, too, is people are learning less how to spell on their own when they can always rely on autocorrect. So that's part of the problem of today as well.
That actually is. I agree with you.
That's a whole other show for another time where we can talk about the horrors of autocorrect. We are going to take a break. When we come back on the other side, we'll continue our discussion with Robert W. Bly. We'll be talking with him throughout the course of the night. We'll talk more about some of the stories from Freak Show of the Gods. We'll also take more of your questions through the wormhole. If you want to submit them to us now, just go to midnightinthedesert.com and we'll be sure to ask them before the show is over. We'll take a break and be back with more Midnight in the Desert in just a few moments. And welcome back to Midnight in the Desert. We are talking about strange, offbeat, and bizarre tales with our guest tonight, Robert W. Bly. Just a reminder, too, that we did extend the Twin Peaks grand prize drawing, that you can still submit your Twin Peaks code phrases from all of last week for your chance to win two silver package tickets to Twin Peaks 30, happening April 5th through the 7th at Graceland in Memphis, Tennessee. So we have all the information up on the Midnight in the Desert Facebook page. If you just go there, you'll be able to see how you can enter and how you can get all those code phrases again if you want to try and take a shot at winning those tickets. All right, let's get back into the discussion with Robert W. Bly. And before the break, we were talking about some of the stories from Freak Show of the Gods, and we're going to continue on with doing that. But one of the things that came up in the Midnight Society Facebook group, Bob, during the break, was people were talking about Stephen King and about his works and about how one of the criticisms of his works is the coming up with the ending. You know, sometimes it seems like King books end in spite of themselves. And that's a valid criticism as far as I'm concerned, but it's also going to be a very challenging concept, not only as a science fiction writer, but just as a writer in general, to come up with a satisfying ending that you feel will wrap up the story in the way that all your readers will appreciate.
Well, there are the two basic methods, and this is based on reading a lot of interviews with writers, including King, and also my own work, as minor as it is compared with them. Some of them say, I don't write the book until I know how it's going to end. James Patterson is in that category. He works from a very tight outline, and he knows before the novel actually is started, but he starts writing it, how it's going to end. And the other way to do it, which is the way I do short stories, is write the scene, write the setup, the scene, the place, the characters, the idea, like, you know, the rubber band man, and see where it goes. And there's pros and cons of both methods. Stephen King, I agree, sometimes the stories end in ways that I thought could be stronger, but other times they're very chilling. My favorite ending, did you read Pet Sematary?
Oh, yes.
So my favorite ending is the last two lines of Pet Sematary, where he buries his wife in the Pet Sematary. She comes back from the dead, and the back door opens, and the guy's sitting on the floor playing solitaire. And the last two lines are, Rachel's voice was grating, full of dirt. Darling, it said, and it just chilled me because of the word it. So sometimes I think he's very good at endings, and other times not so much.
Well, I've always had my suspicions, though, that, and it is a lot of the later works that people complain about the endings with. So my suspicion has always been that by that point, he's already started another book. And because he's so prolific and he's putting out, at one point he's putting out 2 to 3 novels a year, that it's almost like he's already started on the next story and he just has to kind of wrap that one up to be done with it. And so, I can kind of understand some of that as in the process of writing.
Yeah, I being so much less prolific in fiction, don't do that. I write my stories one at a time, And what other authors do, I don't know. I do know a few authors, and I never even thought to ask them this. You know, one of my friends is, like the guys you know, is not a Stephen King, but he's, you know, a successful paperback horror novelist. And I'm going to ask him after, maybe I'll ask him tomorrow, do you work on three at once, or is it one, finish, and then start the other? I really don't know.
Because a good ending is a key thing for a memorable piece of science fiction. I mean, you don't want to build this whole world and build this character development just to undersell it and shortchange it, I should say, with the ending being anticlimactic. I mean, the ending has to be just as strong as the rest of the piece.
Yeah, I gave my book, or a friend of mine was reading my book, who does what I do. He's an advertising copywriting. He says, and he reviewed it on Amazon. He says, I really like the book. The only thing is, I like stories with an O. Henry ending, you know, a dynamite ending, and not all of these have it. So, yeah, the ending is a tough part.
Well, let's get back into some of the stories from Freak Show of the Gods. And, of course, today being President's Day, I want to ask you about you have a story that involves, well, not really a president, but kind of a version of a president.
Yes, the story is called The Emancipation of Abraham Lincoln, XL3000. And I think I'm a little older than you are, because I first went to the World's Fair in 1964, when it opened in New York, and that's when the Hall of Presidents opened. Now, you can go to Disney today, and it's still operating. And we were amazed that there were these animatronic beings, historical figures, the most interesting of which to me was, and the most realistic, was Abraham Lincoln, which moved and looked at you and it talked to you. So I thought, based on that, not at the time in 64, but when my kids were younger and I took them to Disney and we saw it again, and I loved it really just as much as when I saw it the first time, I said, what if they've upgraded it? Because, you know, it's 30 years. What if they put some chips in it? You know, what could they take something like this and, you know, put a microprocessor in it to control it? Could they upgrade the hardware to the point where it's true AI? So my story, I said, if Abraham Lincoln had AI and achieved self-awareness, as happens in so many science fiction stories, what would he want to do? And in the story, Abraham Lincoln, what was his big obsession? Freedom. He hated slavery. But what if he, being chained to the Hall of Presidents and doing the same routine 40 times a day, what if he thought he was a prisoner or a slave and he wanted to be emancipated from Disney? What would happen?
I like that. And I think that people will have no problem suspending any kind of belief with that, because first of all, the Hall of Presidents even today is still so lifelike for people that go and visit it. But also, like you said, we are afraid of the machines coming to life, and this is not the machine coming to life. It's not the evil machine. When people would see this come to life, they'd be like, well, that's Abe Lincoln. He's got a point.
Yeah, in my story, he's not evil. He doesn't hurt anybody. He just wants to escape and get out however he can. In terms of AI achieving self-awareness, there are people who believe it will happen. My youngest son is a software engineer, and he said, Dad, that will happen within 30 to 50 years. And Elon Musk, I read, is so worried about artificial intelligence / awareness of machines. Now he's a libertarian, and they like to keep the government out of their business. He thinks that there should be government control of AI development and research, because he's so worried about it.
Well, I think part of that is because we are putting more and more of our lives in the hands of machines. So, okay, fine. You know, you can talk about computers becoming self-aware and people maybe don't fear that as much. But when you start to say, okay, well, 5 years from now, you won't be driving your car anymore. Your car will be driving you. And that's the kind of AI that freaks people out. You know, when we no longer have control of the vehicles and the airplanes and the things like that, that's where people are going to be concerned that if there was a machine revolt, this would be the way that they would be able to get us.
Yeah, that is the biggest concern, both in fiction and also among many people, including Ray Kurzweil, the futurist. In fact, Stephen King did his movie Maximum Overdrive. It wasn't about AI so much, but somehow the trucks became sentient, and they basically took over the world. What can we do against an 18-wheeler?
Right, and you know, the idea of machines becoming sentient is not anything new. I mean, we've had robots in storytelling for as long as we've had any idea. I mean, you can go back to Metropolis, and even before that, of there being these type of characters.
Yeah, Rossum's Universal Robot, the first fictional robot. Even before that, the Golem.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, I mean, it's we have a reason to have an innate fear of that, and all. I mean, I always try to take that with a grain of salt, though, because I always think, as smart as the machines may become, we could always just unplug them, right?
Well, there are many machines that are so... I'm not sure that's true. There are many machines that are so wired into the power grid that unplugging them would be difficult. I think of the movie, not a good movie, but the movie Superman 4, where this computer becomes sentient and Superman has to stop it, and he can't because when he tries to unplug it, it reaches out and just at a distance draws wireless power, which is something that Tesla conceived of. It draws wireless power, and we have that now with the transfer of putting two iPhones together and charging them, and it was able to draw its own power even if after we tried to stop it. So who knows? And some, again, some machines could be equipped with, with other forms of energy, atomic, solar. So it's not just a matter of pulling the plug. And I understand why you say what you said, but, you know, we don't know that for sure.
Well, now I'm terrified. No, but that's true. I mean, there is always these advances that make it, and you're exactly right. I could have my cell phone sitting on the end table and choose not to charge it because I want to let it die and not have anybody be able to contact me. And there are ways that people could charge it remotely without me even knowing. This is real technology that's coming to fruition. We're actually going to get to the point now. I saw an article the other day where they said that the future of cell phones would be that the same tower that provides the cell service for the phones would also provide the charging power for the phone, so your battery would never go down.
Yeah, and that was a variation of an idea first proposed in a paper by Tesla. So absolutely, there's many ways that a device or a machine, whether mundane or sentient, can get power without simply just plugging into a wall outlet.
Well, the more I think about the cell phone, the more I think now this little thing knows everything about me. It's never far from my reach. It's hearing every conversation that I'm having. We know about the way that businesses now can place ads based on conversations that you've had that have nothing to do with anything that you've searched online. So when the machines do become sentient, it's going to be because of these cell phones that led that to it happening. I'm pretty sure.
Yeah, Arthur C. Clarke had a story, and I don't remember the name, where it wasn't so much making it sentient, but it was based on the telephone network or the telecommunications network becoming so large and having so many nodes that the scientist in the story calculates, if we reach this many nodes, we're going to approximate the number of neurons in the human brain and what will happen then. And as soon as later in the story they hit that number, the whole telecommunications system becomes sentient and self-aware.
I mean, and going back to Stephen King, not that I want to keep bringing him up, but he had that book that was not good, and the movie that came out based on it was even worse, but Cell, where it was the cell phones that turned everybody into zombies.
Yeah, it's funny you mentioned that. I was trying to think of what are the worst Stephen King books, and I thought Cell was probably the worst, and Insomnia was pretty bad too. And yeah, the cell phones would turn everyone into zombies in a way that was not really explained.
Well, hold on now, because let me make sure I have this right. isn't Insomnia the one that's part of the it's a little bit more of the Dark Tower?
No, Insomnia is not part of the Dark Tower series. Insomnia is about I don't remember it that well, but it's not at all part of the Dark Tower, and people develop certain powers, and it starts with a guy who can never sleep. But no, it's not a Dark Tower book.
No, but I think it is, because I'm looking it up here to have these recollections, and it does involve the Crimson King. So it's part of the bigger kind of storytelling arc. But yeah, it was not a good novel unto itself.
It was bad. But what I meant to say is it's not part of the sequential Dark Tower series.
Right, and I hate to give a spoiler alert to people, but it's been long enough since the Dark Tower series wrapped up. But it ends with the idea that, you know, the Dark Tower exists within Stephen King, and every book in the Stephen King universe pretty much in some way connects back to the Dark Tower. So that's a Michelle, put that down on the list of topics for future shows that we have to go into, because that when I first read that, and it was so innocuous. I walked into a Barnes & Noble, and there was a book about the world of Stephen King and how it all interconnects. And I said, well, let me read this. And I swear to you, I read the entire book sitting in Barnes & Noble.
I hate to admit that I've done the same thing with short books, too. And it's something they don't love, but they tolerate.
Right. They're like, hey, we're just happy people keep reading. You know, if you read one here for free, you'll buy five more next week.
That's the idea. When Barnes & Noble first started putting out chairs and then serving coffee, some people said they're crazy. They're just going to have people come in here and read for free. But we know if you get a free sample, you want more. It's like going to the mall and some guy's carrying a tray of sample Chick-fil-A's with toothpicks. You go to take one and say, I'm going to get free food, and you eat it and say, I better pick up a couple of boxes.
Right, exactly. And, you know, they must have known what they were doing, because they're the only ones still around. So it shows that they were right. Getting back into some of the stories from Freak Show of the Gods, well, let's talk about the title story.
Well, the idea of it. Well, what it's about is that a guy takes his kid to the circus, and there's a freak show tent, which is when I was a kid, probably when you were too, they actually had. And so they go to the freak show tent, and the people there displayed as freaks all seem to be some variation in some way of Greek historic fictional characters and gods. For example, there's one guy who looks sort of sickly, but he puts his hand on a light bulb and it lights up. Same thing that they did in X-Men with that guy Bradley. He could generate enough electricity, small amount, to light a light bulb. And we find out that the guy who runs the freak show literally bought these people as if they were property. They were the company. The government was doing genetic engineering to create super soldiers and for other experimentation. And the ones that didn't work, like this guy, they wanted to make him a weapon, but he could only light a spark plug. They wouldn't kill them, but they were just garbage, and he was able to get them and get legal ownership of them, and he made them his freak show. But each person in the freak show, or each genetic experiment or chimera in the freak show, was modeled after another Greek god, Zeus, Neptune, and so on. And I got the idea from this. The title popped into my head, Freak Show of the Gods. Who knows where that came from? And I liked the way it sounded, and came up, and the idea immediately followed in my head. And I said, let me write this one.
So, yeah, I mean, that's a good process to have the title come first. I mean, I know anything that I'm writing, you know, I always agonize over the title, you know, especially I write a lot on the internet, so it's SEO friendly, and, you know, you have to kind of focus on all that. So it's not as freeing as coming up with, you know, title for fiction, but, you know, it sets the tone, and you have to have it be just the perfect thing to give people enough to draw their interest without giving away the story.
Right. Now, I am as I've mentioned a couple of times, a copywriter. So we know that our title is the headline of the ad, and you could take the same ad and just test headline A versus headline B, and I've done this, and headline B with the same copy under it gets 10 times the response of headline A. So the titles do matter.
Absolutely. And, you know, it seems like looking over some of the thematic elements from Freak Show of the Gods, you don't really shy away from things that people might consider to be controversy. I'm looking at the summarization of the story 26 Weeks, and I'm sure that that's something that would draw a lot of emails from readers.
Yeah, I don't try deliberately to offend or be sacrilegious, but again, I write the stories that the ideas pop into me. And 26 Days, the title was didn't dictate that story, but I just had the idea of, I was thinking about God, and there actually you could say it's derivative of the Star Trek episode with Apollo, where he felt he needed worshipers, and without them he had no meaning and he ceased to exist, or he went to another plane of existence. So I said, what if God was not a supreme being but an alien, a race, and the beings of this race, each when they were as they aged, created their own pocket universe in which they were the supreme being. And then what would happen if in this process that it eventually drained a lot of their power and energy till they became much more like an ordinary being, not totally, but much more, and their battery that gave them whatever power they had was the prayers of the worshipers. And therefore, you know, we're living in an age where atheism and agnostics are on the rise. What would happen if no one prayed to them? Would they exist? Would God exist?
So what we're seeing is the deterioration of those gods based on a lack of belief and observation. And it's an allegory that can be applied to the religions that have gone away over time.
Absolutely. I mean, when you stop believing in a religion's specific God, and nobody is left to think about it, does he exist? It's really almost the same with people. There was a book, I don't know if you read it, A Brief History of the Dead, where the idea is, part of it was based on, once everyone who ever knew you, you're dead. Once everyone but you go to another place. Once everyone who knew you is dead, did you ever exist?
Mm-hmm.
Do you still exist in the afterlife? You're gone.
It's a question that we bring up in paranormal research all the time. That, you know, how can your ghost hang around? How can you still exist? Because people still talk about you, because your name still is out there, because there's still descendants that might mention you, but that eventually, when that fades away, so will your ability to come back.
Exactly. And that, so this is, based on that idea that it's the belief and the memory that keeps you alive, especially for a human, once after you've passed. And I think about that myself. My kids are in their 30s, but eventually, many years from now, they will be gone. Their children who might remember me, the grandchildren will be gone. And all the friends I have will be gone. Did I even exist?
I mean, the good thing is in today's day and age, we have, you know, things like Ancestry and people are actually chronicling their family history a lot better than they have in the past. So it will allow for at least our names to go on. But it doesn't mean that people will remember and understand the essence of who we were as people.
Yeah. And, there have been nonfiction and fiction works both that posit that eventually our consciousness, our brain, what if you want to say our thoughts, will be able to be recorded onto some high-density electronic device that will sense, in essence, make us immortal. It's nothing like that even close to exist yet, but some people believe, like Ray Kurzweil believes, it's a possibility.
Yeah, I mean, we do have that ability to some degree now, though. I mean, I remember my dad's brother passed away when I was young, And I happened to find cleaning up my grandparents' basement an old cart from when he worked at a radio station and did what I did. And it did the news, the news broadcasts. And at the time that I found it, that's what I was doing for a living. So it was special to not only make that connection, but to be able to, you know, revive my father's brother, who we hadn't heard in probably 30 years at that point, just from this simple recording. And so that's something that we can at least know that we live in an age where that possibility will exist.
I agree with that. And it's that was the notion that, that engaged me and has engaged many other both fiction and nonfiction writers. That's where that story came from.
All right. We're going to take a break here coming up. When we come back on the other side, we'll talk more with Robert W. Bly about Freak Show of the Gods, as well as some of the other science fiction topics that we have on the plate for tonight. If you would like to pick up the book or any of his books, you can just go to midnightinthedesert.com. That will link you over to his websites, including bly.com, BLY.com, and sciencefictionprediction.com. And you'll be able to find out more about him, more about his works. You can also follow him on Twitter at Robert Bly, BLY, if you'd like to do that as well. So we are going to take a break. We'll come back and talk more about some of these stories, as well as some other science fiction ideas and concepts when Midnight in the Desert returns. Welcome back to Midnight in the Desert. We'll get right back into the discussion tonight with our guest, Robert W. Bly. But I just want to let everybody know about what is coming up on this week's programs on Midnight in the Desert. And of course, we have a new format of how we're releasing this each week. If you just go to the Midnight in the Desert Facebook page, go to that page right now, if you haven't already, and hit the like button. And when you do that, you'll be able to follow what we put out on that page. And of course, you want to get in there and interact with the page as well. Every day when you see the different posts that go up about who the guests are, give that post a like. Give that post a share. Share it with your friends, because not only might they want to join in and listen in as well, but also the more you engage with our page, the more you'll see it show up in your timeline. So you'll know what it is that we're doing each and every day and all the different announcements that we have to make. But each weekend on Sunday, we put out our guest list for the week so that you can plan how you want to stay up for Midnight in the Desert. You can say, hey, maybe this night I definitely want to make sure I take a nap so that I can stay up and listen live, as opposed to maybe the rest of the time that you listen via the archives. However you want to do it, we want to make sure that you know exactly what's coming up on the slate. So tomorrow night, we'll be joined by guest Dr. Bruce Olav Solheim about paranormal encounters with ETs, and also with ghosts, with angels, with demons, with telepathy, all of that, and how it ties in to paranormal encounters with extraterrestrials. Then on Wednesday, we'll be talking with Maury Zelkovich about reprogramming your mind. That's right. You can actually reprogram and shift your brain from one of hopelessness, despair, and a deep burning of cynicism like Maury did, to one that is an attitude of gratitude and a sense of happiness, fulfillment, and purpose. You'll find out all about that. On Thursday, Lon Milo Duquette, the mystical world of tarot, Kabbalah, and ceremonial magic. So that's going to be a really fascinating show, because he is definitely one of the higher ups and one of the most mystical organizations that is out there. We'll find out all about that on Thursday. And then on Friday, David Ditchfield, Creative Gifts Brought Back from Beyond. He'll be talking with us about his near-death experience and how coming back from that gives people a newfound creative purpose. So a great week of interesting and enlightening topics here on Midnight in the Desert, as always. And we are having one of those discussions right now as we're talking about strange, offbeat, and bizarre tales with our guest, author Robert W. Bly. And Bob, we've been talking about Freak Show of the Gods and some of these stories that are appearing in the book. And I'm already seeing comments from people on social media and in the wormhole. Everybody's saying, you know, I got to pick up a copy of this book, which, of course, as we mentioned, you can do so by going to midnightinthedesert.com. But as I'm looking over these lists of some of the stories and the titles of the stories, all I can think of, and I mean this as a compliment, and I hope that you'll take it this way, it sounds like a bunch of log lines for a season of The Twilight Zone.
The nicest reviews I've gotten on Amazon have been people who say, if you enjoyed The Twilight Zone, you'll enjoy these stories. The Twilight Zone, I didn't copy any of the plots, but that is sort of a model, that the tales, the stories, most of them have this kind of twist on reality. And I was a huge Twilight Zone fan, as a lot of people listening are. And, yeah, people say it reminds me of Twilight Zone. of Harlan Ellison. And so I don't take that as an insult. I take it as a compliment. I'm happy that people would think that.
Well, this is coming from a guy that has a picture of Rod Serling hanging up right behind his head in his office. So, you know that I mean that in all the best ways. But yeah, that's it. That's the idea of it, is the fact that not only is it these self-contained worlds that you can get into with these stories, but even in just looking at some of the pictures for these stories, I'm reading them and saying, well, I know that this, I'm coming away from reading this not only being entertained, but it also has somewhat of a deeper message to it as well.
Some of them do, and some of the reviewers who've written on Amazon have noted that very well, because science fiction, in addition to the fantastic, in addition to the fascinating, has, you know, it goes to the core of human emotion. William Faulkner said words to the effect that the only thing writing about is the human heart in conflict with itself. Now, I don't actually believe that. Philip Dick said science fiction is first based on a great idea, and then you put people into it, and that's what makes it interesting. But yes, there is, to both my stories, I hope, and to many, many science fiction stories, there is a broader or a deeper message. And if you make it too obvious, it's preaching and boring. But if it's subtle, it adds emotional verisimilitude to the story.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing about great, and not even just great science fiction, but really any great storytelling, it has to have the humanity behind it, because that's what people will make that connection to. And so often people try to go into storytelling as, I don't want to say cold, but like they don't really understand the need to kind of have those characters that resonate. It's not just about telling a character story. It's about telling the story and making the audience want to feel that connection to those characters.
Absolutely. And it's the characters that, again, turbocharge the emotional elements in a story, and people are much more responsive to emotion than they are to fact.
There's also, though, when you read some stories from different writers, there are some stories that do have a desperation to them. They don't always necessarily reflect the best of humanity, but they give us warnings about where we could go. I mean, I think science fiction is a great cautionary tale or a great way to share cautionary tales of where we can go if we aren't cognizant of the fact that we are already starting down some of these paths.
Yes. One criticism a few of the reviews of mine said is that, hey, warning, not all of these stories have happy endings. I don't think all stories should have happy endings. A warning story, for example, do you remember the story of Arthur C. Clarke, the 9 billion names of God?
No, I don't think so.
So this sect of monks in Tibet, or some odd religious order, buys from Cray their latest supercomputer and to be delivered and installed. And what's the project? Their religion believes that the mission of man on Earth is to find out all the names of God, which they have calculated as 9 billion. And instead of now taking 500 centuries with this computer, it's going to be quick. So the computer runs, and they get a note or an email from the Tibetan Center saying the computer just finished. We have the 9 billion names of God. And the guy at the computer company is driving home from work. He says, well, what was really the point of that? And he looks up, and all of the stars above him are starting to wink out.
Oh. Yeah. So that definitely sounds like a cautionary tale for sure. Now, with your stories in Freak Show of the Gods, I mean, we talked before about kind of using other properties and other intellectual creations. And I'm looking at one of these, and it's just reading the plot line of it. It just made me laugh out loud, because it's so perfect in where we go with a lot of these things, where we see some of these stories. We just had a Dacre Stoker on the show a few weeks ago, who is the great grandnephew of Bram Stoker. And wow. he was he was talking with us about, you know, we talked about the new version of Dracula and how, you know, the Dracula story never goes away. You have a story called Van Helsing's Last Stand that I think is a very humorous take on where this could go.
Well, Van Helsing's Last Stand, and that's one that instead of the plot coming to me, the title popped into my head. Van Helsing's Last Stand. I like the sound of it. I said, now what story would that be about? So I said, what if, and of course a lot of fantasy and science fiction and other fiction begins with what if. What if Van Helsing, in fact, was the pen name of Bram Stoker, and he wrote the novel based on his actual vampire hunting. And then he's confronted in the story by Dracula, who has been asking him he says, hey, you're making all this money off our stories. I want part of the merchandising, the movie rights, and the book royalties. And it comes to, rather than a legal battle, it comes to a physical battle in which Van Helsing could be killed, but for some reason that I don't think the reader would anticipate. In fact, Dracula is not able to kill him.
And that's kind of what it's all about. I mean, even in that that new version of Dracula, they even talk to him about, you know, securing like book rights and movie rights to his story and all that. I mean, it's funny because we can look at those kind of things tongue in cheek, but in actuality, that's probably how it would play out in the real world. You know, it would be more.
Yeah, go ahead.
I was going to say it would be more about, you know, be more about those rights than it would be anything else.
Yeah, I mean, it's not beyond imagination to say, well, if you accept that there would be a character named Dracula and someone would have written books and movies about him, he's alive, he has property, he lives in Carfax Abbey or wherever he lives, and, you know, he would have a legal claim on having his life story appropriated without compensation.
Yeah, I mean, that's... If you are telling the story of a fictional character and that fictional character is no longer fictional, then you're right. They have a claim to that. And I think that it's fun to also, and I'm sure you enjoy this process, it's fun to play around sometimes with other people's characters as long as you're keeping the spirit of them, you know, in mind as you're doing it. But it's always fun to say, you know, let's see where else we can take this that the original creator never thought of.
Yes, a lot of fantasy and science fiction writers enjoy doing that from time to time, and I am certainly one of them.
I mean, look at how many, different writers have worked on Star Wars books or Star Trek books. It's because they have a passion for those characters, and they want to use them as part of their storytelling mode, and you see some great, great stories that come out of those. I mean, I remember reading Star Trek books when I first discovered Star Trek. And you could only maybe watch one episode a week because it wasn't like I had, you know, cable DVDs or anything. So you would go and you'd find these books in the library, and it would be these whole new vast worlds that you never saw on the television series that just expanded that universe for you and got your own mind thinking about some of the possibilities.
Yes, and one of the most prolific authors of the Star Trek novelizations and original paperback stories was the great science fiction writer James Blish, who wrote the classic Cities and Flight series.
And there's pretty much any property that people are fans of, you know, you can find some of these novelizations, not so much now, because it's more the other way around where the properties being created, you know, the movies, the TV series is being based on the novels. But I remember, you know, we talked about last week, I was a huge Quantum Leap fan. There was a whole series of Quantum Leap novels. Twin Peaks we did last week. There's a series of Twin Peaks novels. So people were always looking to go deeper into that storytelling and using novels and short stories as a way to do it.
Somehow I never pushed to do it or got to do it, but I always thought that I would enjoy doing novelizations. Didn't happen, but the shows you mentioned and many other shows are, you know, have novelizations. One of the ones that had the most was a soap opera from when you and I were younger, Dark Shadows. There was like 100 novelizations.
Wow, I didn't know that.
Yeah, most of them were written by a prolific paperback author named Arthur Ross, who wrote under several pen names, and he wrote in his lifetime more than 320 published novels.
Well, I mean, when you think about it, though, the dark shadows genre, I mean, it fits right into, as much as, you know, people that like the horror, the science fiction, the stuff that we like, as much as we liked Dark Shadows, in the end, it was a soap opera. And so the novels that are based on it are very much like, I'm sure, those romance novels that come out, where at one point my grandmother had probably 300 or 400 of those, you know, stacked up on a table, where people are just constantly consuming that kind of content.
Yeah, one of the big romance publishers, I don't keep up with the field, for many years in mass market paperbacks, was Silhouette Press and Harlequin Romance. I think it was the same company. And I was curious. I wrote to them, and they sent me a guideline for potential authors. And all the stories, you know, you could read the guideline, were very formulaic, because the readers, their customers, basically wanted to read. They knew they liked the story they read. They wanted the same experience over and over again. I've heard it said that that's by people in publishing. That's why any series books, they tend to sell better than single character. People read Lee Child, the Jack Reacher novels, and they're not, to me, that different. But people want, they know when they pick up a Jack Reacher novel, if they like the last one, they're going to enjoy the one they just bought, because they don't want to take a risk with, you know, when spending $30 or $25 on a hardcover in buying something they might not like.
Yeah, and I remember I read something when I was younger that it said, you know, it was kind of an overview of authors in general. And it said, one of the questions that it posed was, well, who is V.C. Andrews? And it said, V.C. Andrews isn't a person. V.C. Andrews is a team of people writing under that name, working together to create these stories based on what they think, you know, the audience is looking for next. It's not out of a creative direction. It's out of a marketing direction. And I think that that does play a part in a lot of these series, but you don't see that the same way in science fiction novelizations. You know, you see that creativity in it. It seems like it's serving the author's creativity more than it is serving what they think the audience wants to consume.
Yes, and it's interesting you mentioned that, which I did not know, that V.C. Andrews was a conglomeration of people. It was the same thing. Remember the old Nancy Drew books? There are about 10 authors that wrote Nancy Drew books.
Yeah, and I don't see anything wrong with that.
Not
I know.
Some people
get upset about it, but in the end, you know, sometimes it just takes multiple people to create the stories that they're trying to tell. Same thing with a movie or a television show.
Well, look at the, to me, almost bizarre thing that's starting to go on now. You can still buy Spencer for Hire books. That's, you know, Robert Parker's character, and he passed away years ago, and they have other authors. Ace Atkins is the current one now, taking over the Spencer series. And I'll be, in my opinion, and I loved Robert B. Parker, Ace Atkins is, you know, 80 to 90% is good. I enjoy his books very much. And I said to someone, it's sort of sad. No one's indispensable. Even you don't need Robert Parker to make Robert Parker books. It's a little sad to me, but that's the way the world is.
And now I saw something pop up on Facebook last week that they're bringing Spencer back as a new Netflix series.
I'm really glad about that. You know, the Netflix has brought back or brought to the screen a number of good characters. You know, the people have different opinions on the quality of the various shows, but that is something I would watch, and I'm glad they're doing it. I did not know that.
Yeah, I forget what it was. I forget who is involved in it. I'd have to go back and find it. But I was reading the story, and I said, "Well, I will watch that. I'm not upset about that." But that's what we get when we have good quality characters and good quality storytelling. You want to see it live on. Now, that's different than a reboot. That's different than a remake. That's just the continuing story of a character. Like, look at James Bond. They're about to release the 25th movie of the James Bond franchise, and there were novels before there were books, and it's a character that is so beloved and has been handled in so many different ways that you can do that. Sometimes the character outlives the character's creator.
Yeah, and in James Bond's case, he has done so for many, many years.
I mean, we talked about comic books earlier, but that's just the nature of comic books in general. You know, you want a comic book to outlive the creators and the original storytellers.
Yeah, I mean, even now, unfortunately now, Stan Lee recently died. And, you know, before that, you know, it was Siegel and Shuster who created Superman and their tragic story of not being compensated for what they should have, or some people think they should have. But, yeah, these characters all outlive their creators.
Now, you have, in Freak Show of the Gods, you have an interesting superhero story called Early Retirement.
This was based on an idea that occurred to me when this happened. I went online to check my Social Security. What am I going to get in Social Security? And I didn't realize this, but it's somewhat based on what you put in, or I didn't think about it, and, you know, and that depends on earnings. Well, I have at least one, possibly two associates or friends that, you know, are under the table. You know, they're not in the mainstream economy. You know, that would be an example. Might be if you're a contractor, and you may have seen this. Contractor will say, "Well, can you just pay me in cash?" And you know, you're supposed to pay tax on all your income, but you know they're asking for that because they don't want to pay tax on it. Well, the problem is if you don't pay tax on what you do, your Social Security when you retire is going to be like $3. So in my story, Early Retirement, an aging superhero, sort of a stand-in for Superman, wants to retire, applies for Social Security, and he can't get it. And the results are sad for him and then tragic for the city.
I mean, it really is. When you think about it, like, you can't put a dollar value on what it is that they do, and we really do take advantage of our superheroes. You know,
the only show where they get paid, I think, is The Boys.
Right. And they probably don't deserve it in that show.
They really don't. They should be in prison.
Yeah, we generally rely on, you know, our Batmans and our Iron Mans to be, you know, self-sufficient billionaires who can pay their own way, or Superman who doesn't really need all the creature comforts. You know, there really should be better care. Of course, we just need to get to the point too where we can accept our superheroes. I mean, just ask the Watchmen or the X-Men or any of that. They'd be happy just to be accepted in society.
Yeah, and you talk about pay. You know, Bruce Wayne is portrayed as wealthy, Iron Man, but in the Avengers movies, Captain America like lives in a tiny apartment in Brooklyn. It's all he can afford. He's, you know, and it's in a less desirable neighborhood. He doesn't have money.
I mean, the good thing is he doesn't have to worry about getting mugged either.
No, he really doesn't.
So speaking of taxes, you have another story that involves taxes in Freak Show of the Gods too.
Yeah, this is on something that actually happens a lot in taxes. People will want to make a deduction on an activity, and the IRS, it's disallowed. One of the reasons it's disallowed, you know, someone will say, well, I make, a woman will say, or a man will say, I make lanyards, or I make necklaces, or little crafts at home, and the IRS will say, well, you can only discuss it, you can only deduct it if it's a business. And if it's a hobby, which means you've made less than $3,000 a year with it, and you took a deduction, it's illegal. So in this story, a genius inventor is building a time machine. He's a professor at a local university, but he's doing this project, funding it entirely with his own money, and doing it in his home laboratory. And the IRS audits him and sees that he's deducted for all this expensive machinery and equipment. And he says, well, does this make money for you? And he said, no, it's not, you know, it's not working yet, but it will. He says, well, right now, he said, do you have investors? No. He says, this isn't a business, and it's not part of your university job. You know, you teach in a different area of physics. Your deductions that you've taken over several years are illegal, and you're going to have a huge tax bill. So when the IRS agent leaves, the inventor says, can I get my time machine working in time to go back in time and correct my mistake in filling out tax returns so I don't go to jail or get a huge penalty? And it goes on from there.
I think a lot of us, though, would probably want to travel back in time to some different things we've tried to claim on our taxes now and then.
Yeah. And in his case, and a lot of people's cases, although ignorance of the law is no excuse, they just didn't know. That's what it is in this story. You know, some people, like I said, like the contractors who ask for cash, they know. They know they're cheating. But a lot of people don't realize it, and they make mistakes that cost them a lot of money, and, you know, they wish they knew. Sometimes it's their accountant does the thing wrong, and they're not sophisticated enough, as most of us are, to understand complex tax returns, and they get stung.
Well, that's certainly an appropriate story for this time of year, as everybody's starting to get ready to file their taxes. We're going to take a break. When we come back on the other side, we'll continue our discussion with Robert W. Bly, talking about strange, offbeat, and bizarre tales. We'll continue talking about some of the stories in Freak Show of the Gods, which, again, you can pick up from midnightinthedesert.com, as well as some of his other books as well. We're going to talk more about superheroes coming up. We're going to be talking more about some other different stories in science fiction and different themes in science fiction, horror, and other type of genres as well. If you want to submit any questions via the wormhole, then you can do that at midnightinthedesert.com. If for some reason you're not a time traveler yourself, speaking of time travel, if you're not a time traveler at midnightinthedesert.com, well, you should sign up for it so that you can submit questions via the wormhole. But if not, you can always send them via email. And we did get a question in from Nancy. What's the difference between sentient and self-aware? And I say that, I describe that as this. I'm sentient, but I have very little self-awareness. We'll take a break. We'll be back with more Midnight in the Desert in just a moment. Back in here on Midnight in the Desert, we are talking with Robert W. Bly about strange, offbeat, and bizarre tales, a lot of them coming from his book, Freak Show of the Gods, which I see a lot of you are already saying that you plan on picking up. Just go to midnightinthedesert.com. That's where you can find out all about all the great books from our different guests every night, and you can pick them up right there, and it helps out the show if you buy them through our site as well. Same as becoming a time traveler. That, of course, helps support the show as well. And you can submit questions into the wormhole if you're a time traveler. You can download the archives if you're a time traveler. In fact, you can even let some of your friends know, if you weren't aware of this, anywhere that they pick up podcasts, we usually put out 1 hour of the show each night for free. So share that around and get people to listen to that first hour of Midnight in the Desert. And I promise you, they'll become time travelers. And they're going to want to listen to the whole 3-hour show every night. And then you'll have something to talk about with them. You can talk about your interest in the show, and you can talk about your interest in the topics that we talk about here on the program as well. And, you know, interest is something that we need to keep building in a lot of the things that we talk about, not only here, but the things that we like to read about as well, because it's easy. It's so easy for modern society to push things aside. And unfortunately, it seemed like that was going to be the case with reading for a long time. And we were talking earlier with our guest, Robert Bly, about the fact that, you know, Harry Potter saved reading for a lot of the younger generation. And now some of that's happening with the popularity of comic book characters. This question came in via email. He says, this is from Fred. He asks, he believes something that is missing today is the encouragement of children to actually read books of any kind, especially science fiction. His mother, rest her soul, did not care that he was reading comic books, Mad Magazine, or encyclopedias. She said the key was to read, read, read. And is that type of encouragement missing in today's youth? Even though we were saying, Robert, that they do listen, they do read some of these books and some of these topics, are we seeing that expanding enough beyond just the characters and the properties that they're interested in?
I view it as a desperate struggle. Yes, we are encouraging kids to read comic books, novels, interesting nonfiction. The children's book business is brisk, but these kids have more competing for their attention than you and I did when we were their age. When I was a kid, there was 4 television channels to choose from. Now, with the system we're hooked up with, I think we have 400. So there's so much content being put out in every format. And it's not just television, you know, or Netflix. It's video games.
Mm-hmm.
It's computers. There's so much more content and so much alternative media that there's a lot to interest you out there. But when we were kids, if we wanted to live in the world of fantasy or imagination, the main way to do it was to read, and the second way to do it was through some TV or movies, but that was it.
Right. I mean, the storytelling is still there, especially when it comes to video games. The worlds that they're creating, the characters, the storytelling that they're creating, it's better than some of the movies that come out. But the problem is it's still somebody presenting that to you with the vision that they have for it. It's not the same as picking up a novel about it and being able to immerse yourself in that world. And I think, you know, the same thing that Fred's saying, you know, anything that you can read is great. Just read, read, read. The problem is that it's become so specialized that it's not like, you know, the days when I was a kid where I would literally, I would get $5. My dad would, we'd go to the flea market. My dad sold stuff at a flea market on the weekends. And if I helped out, I would get $5. And I could use that $5 to walk around and buy whatever I wanted. And I would either spend it on comic books, and because I was trying to get the most value, you know, I'd pick up a bunch of the 10 cents each or the 25 cents each back issues or the less popular titles. Or I'd go around and I'd pick up, you know, novels that people had sitting on their table. You know, most of the time the cover was ripped off and they were 25 cents each. And that's what I would do, is I would never think twice about just buying a book and giving it a try and jumping into that world. And now it's like people look at it and they say, well, am I going to spend $25 on this hardcover? Is this something that I really want to read? Maybe I can just go and get the shorter version of it online or the overview of it online. And we lose a lot of that just taking the risks of reading that we used to have in the older days.
I totally agree. But to your other comment, you are right about video games. The ones that now have movies built into them, combined with the play action, especially some of the superhero ones, are great. They're just fantastic. My kids, who are adults, love Injustice and got me into it, which is the Superman video game where, well, I don't want to spoil the plot, but Superman eventually becomes the ruler and dictator of Earth and is opposed by another side of superheroes led by Batman. And not only is the story great and the voices are great, the graphics are out of this world. I mean, they're unbelievable. And they have the same thing with Batman with the video game Arkham Asylum.
The Injustice series will always have my heart because even though it's some of the gameplay is maybe further than I can do, they did include my favorite comic character, Ambush Bug, which nobody knows Ambush Bug. Nobody remembers Ambush Bug, but I try and tell them, you know, he was the precursor to Deadpool. He was the one that was breaking down the fourth wall before Deadpool did. So, Keith Giffen, if you're listening to this show, we would love to have you on. We'd love to talk about Ambush Bug. And if you've retired from it, please let me take over the property because I've got some ideas. But that's what we want to see. We want to see the generation of people that are taking these characters and taking these ideas behind these characters and bringing them to another level, so that the you know, as you were talking about before with the story about how the gods only live as long as people worship them, these characters will only survive as long as people keep telling stories utilizing them.
Yes, and I don't personally think comic books or superheroes will ever stop or diminish, but they've been cyclical. You know, again, my friend Andy, who worked for Warner's for, you know, we graduated college in the late 70s together, and he said definitely the popularity is cyclical, and you know, and he said, very hard today to make a living with a comic book store. Adults want to read them, but they like to buy the books in Barnes and Noble or on Amazon.
Well, and the other side of it too is that the especially DC and Marvel have been very smart to embrace the digital technology. Where I know I have subscriptions to both, and I can open up my iPad and I can read pretty much any comic going back in time, and I can say, you know what, I think I want to read every single Iron Man comic that ever existed. And Marvel has, you know, gathered them all together under one heading for me to be able to click on it and just start at the beginning and go through them all. And so the collectability factor may be gone, but the storytelling and the access to the storytelling is living on through this digital media.
And sometimes going back and reading the old ones is fun, even in a cheesy sort of way. I had an old Iron Man comic someone gave me as a gift, and Tony was fighting a villain, and he was running out of power, so he pulls something from the side of his armor, and it's a plug, and he plugs it into the wall outlet to charge himself up, which, of course, is not how it works today, but it was, you know, so it was rather funny.
Yeah, I think if you go back and you read, like, especially Iron Man, I mean, I tell people all the time, I used to help out with a great podcast that two of my friends do. I'm going to give it a little plug. It's called Change My Mind. And my friends Nick and Wes, they talk about, you know, the comic book culture and how it bleeds into pop culture now and all that. And it's famous that, you know, Nick loves to read the comics and Wes doesn't like to read the comics, and they go back and forth. And one of the shows that we talked about was about Iron Man and the popularity of the character. And if you had told me prior to Robert Downey Jr. making the first Iron Man movie that the entire Marvel universe was going to be built on the back of basically Iron Man, I would have said, well, that's doomed to fail because he's the worst character ever. But
see, I liked him, but I don't think he's the worst character ever. But I agree, he's not the person I would think would be the foundation of the Marvel universe by any stretch of the imagination.
Well, I shouldn't say worst character ever. That's Thor. Yeah. But the idea is that I'm just kidding. I'm just throwing out names there to mess with people. But no, but that was the idea. It's like it's not a franchise builder. You know, you have to build a franchise around Spider-Man, and you don't have Spider-Man. You have to build a franchise around the X-Men. You don't have the X-Men, so what are you left with? But they've done a great job of not only changing the game, but also, and I didn't think this was going to work at all, and maybe we'll see how it goes in, what's it, Phase 5 that's coming up, because it's going to get even more in-depth with that. But they're turning these superhero stories into science fiction stories.
Yeah, absolutely. Spider-Man, Far From Home, was basically science fiction.
And we're getting, you know, with the Kree and the Captain Marvel stuff and all this, like everything's happening out in space, you know, and it's involving other planets and other species. This is not something that I thought would be easily digestible to the common audience, but yet, you know, these movies keep breaking records.
Yeah, and in the CW, Smallville, and now Supergirl, I mean, there's multiple aliens in almost every show.
Right. I mean, Smallville was great, too, because, I mean, it's one of my favorite TV series of all time. They did a fantastic job of taking not only a Superman story and giving it a fresh take, but they, for the longest time, that series was very much a, you know, a Monster of the Week X-Files type program that, you know, they only touched upon the mythology of Superman a little bit, and they just used that as a storytelling device to basically rip off the X-Files in terms of, like, we're going to give you a different villain with different powers and have to have a different way to fight him, and then next week we'll just move on to something else.
The first season or two, that was all it was, and it was very enjoyable, and the trigger for it was the meteor rock shower that it hit Smallville, the kryptonite in Smallville mutated a lot of children into these creatures, or animals into these creatures. And the kryptonite, of course, kills Clark, but, you know, it played a role it never played in the comic books.
Yeah, and that might have kind of fed into some of the idea behind Brightburn, too, I'm sure.
Yeah, I think it is. And, you know, again, that was, we discussed it earlier. Just still, when you say Brightburn, my mind goes back to it. I just, one of my favorite superhero movies of all time. And, you know, just, it's like you had said at the beginning, well, the ideas have been done. Well, superheroes have been done. But that was a twist that I would not have thought of or expected.
Yeah, if anybody hasn't seen it, like, we're not really spoiling it by telling you this. Like, you need to go back and watch it and give it some room to breathe. You know, don't go into it being like, oh, gee, this seems like the Superman story. Oh, this is just a ripoff of Superman. Give it room to develop and breathe before your eyes, and it'll blow you away. And I thought I saw that they're actually developing a sequel to it, too.
Yes, I heard and read that, and they set it up at the end of the last film with the reports of more super beings in the world. So it'll be interesting to see that. It seems almost certain that they are going to do it. It did well at the box office, and I'm looking forward to that.
I also think that as we're pushing some of these boundaries with these superhero movies, I'm going to have to guess that, you know, science fiction in general is going to see a big push as a result of this, that if people are willing to buy alternate dimensions and other planets and all that stuff in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, then they're going to be able to buy those plot lines in other types of storytelling as well.
Yeah, people don't talk about it a lot, but if you think about it, comic books are just a subgenre of science fiction and fantasy.
Right. I mean, we try to say that, you know, the best stories are the ones that connect with us as people. You know, like Stan Lee famously said, you know, don't tell stories of superheroes. Tell stories of ordinary people that are thrust into the role of superhero. And so that kind of humanizes it. But also, like, I would never would have thought, if you told me, again, if we're going back in time and we're talking about the future of the Marvel Cinematic Universe, if you told me that Guardians of the Galaxy would be a smash hit and play a major role in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, I would also have said, well, that's so niche, and that's such a small corner of comic book fandom. I don't know how that would work. But yet, here we are, over there in the process of creating the third one and even possibly a fourth one, and it's a cornerstone now of the Marvel Universe.
Yes, I feel as you do. If you had told me that beforehand, I'd say, no, that's a little quirky comic book off to the side. It's not going to fit in.
Yeah, that's the great thing about this now, is they're finding ways to take these more obscure characters and make them into something bigger. And I'm sure that's something that you enjoy doing too in your storytelling, is, you know, creating and developing these characters and making people care about them. And you said, you know, as you're writing short stories, you don't really have a lot of words to do that in. How do you try to create characters that will resonate with people so quickly?
I try to make the character sympathetic and going through a difficulty or a problem that arises from the bizarreness of the world or the plot that I have created in the story. For example, in one of my stories, the character starts as a young boy whose father was an astronaut, and they think he died in space. But what happened is he disappeared into a black hole, and the boy is a genius and grows up to be a physicist, and he eventually calculates that his father is alive, and or that the probability that he's alive is high, and the black hole he went through, he identified where he's going to come out and when he's going to come out, and he spends his life trying to unite with the father he lost, you know, which is, you know, to me, the emotion of the relationship between children and their parents is very strong, and for me, especially because I have two boys, a son and a father. And, you know, I've always had this, you know, nothing pulls at my heart like my sons. And so to put this in loss, you know, it's a loss in redemption story.
Right. And it's a universal theme threaded through an extraordinary circumstance. But everybody can relate to that type of love and that type of connection. And there's another story, too, about a couple called Can You Hear Me, where it's kind of the same idea, where you have, you know, a universal theme that just is explored through an extraordinary circumstance.
Right. In that story, a woman who has near death was frozen and placed in a cryogenic facility, which really exists. We all know that. And the idea is to preserve them until they can be revived. And one of the people who, one of the workers who is in, you know, runs the facility or services it, sees her because you can see through the containment unit, and he kind of has a crush on her and falls in love with her, and he finds out that he can communicate with her because the science is that they're not really dead when they're placed there. They are frozen at the moment of death, so the brain is still alive, and the cryogenic suspension, the temperatures are cold enough. in my story, to do superconductivity, so her thoughts were transmitted outside of the container to him and vice versa.
Hmm. So I think that that's got to be a rewarding thing for you to be able to explore some of these themes, but also do it in a way that is kind of mind-bending and intriguing in that regard, but still kind of coming away with this basic human storyline underneath it.
Yeah, the three things that I like are, like, as I say, bizarre or odd Twilight Zone-ish situations, human characters, but when I can, I also like to justify what happens with some hard science. Not that that my readership, you know, is the same as analogs, but if you support it with hard science, it becomes more believable and credible.
Is that how a lot of science fiction writers, at least in your exploration of the genre, is that how they've worked in a way where they wanted to use extraordinary circumstances to reflect on humanity?
A lot of them. A lot of them do, especially people who are considered the more modern or the new wave of writers, like Philip Dick, Philip Jose Farmer, Ray Bradbury. Before that, in the golden age of science fiction, where Asimov and Heinlein and Clark were the big three, a lot of it began not with the with the situation or the drama or the emotion, but it began with science. And a lot of people criticize those stories and say they're not as good, but you can enjoy both. I don't think it's one or the other.
And one thing that science fiction has always done a very good job of is predicting future events and future technologies. Do you think that that is a happy coincidence in a lot of cases, or is it because these writers were so forward-thinking that they could see where things were trending? Were they just as much futurists as they were fiction writers?
They were definitely, and have been for many, many decades, futurists. In fact, I think the early science fiction amateur club with Fred Pohl and Asimov and Robert Silverberg, they were called the futurists. And so they often look forward and in some ways get the predictions that they make, the things that they write about, many of them become reality or at least are on the track where they could become reality. Sometimes the predictions fail. One thing science fiction writers never saw coming was microcomputers. They never thought that a computer could be miniaturized. So Asimov wrote a story where each missile that we fired against our enemies, it was a world war going on, had essentially a mainframe computer built into it to guide it, and it was so heavy that limited its flight. And this is the story, the title I hope will come to me, but also in the future, where calculators have rendered people unable to do simple math, and a technician figures out how to do math, and they realize if they can teach people that, they don't need a heavy mainframe computer. They can put one guy in the missile. Now, he'll be killed, but he'll guide the missile. And the guy who invents this system of math and then learns it'll be used to put people in missiles, he kills himself because it's so horrible.
Wow. And it's not Slim Pickens that they put on the missile, right?
Yes. He also had a similar fate.
It's a little throwback to our episode that we did a few weeks ago. But also, too, when talking about some of these trends, and you wrote a whole book about some of the science that appears in science fiction. But when you talk about some of these ideas, you're right. They might not have foreseen a lot of the things that were coming, but also some of the ideas that people read in science fiction are what inspired some of the modern technology that we have.
Right. For example, submarines. Jules Verne, with 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, he thought of the idea. And there's no doubt that it stimulated others to think about it. And then I don't have the dates in front of me, but 100 years later, 120 years later, the first submarine was built, and the first working metal submarine was tested in Paterson, New Jersey, in the Passaic River where I grew up. So, yeah, there are many examples of people, of science fiction stories that lead to science fiction fact.
And, you know, we always like to simplify it and say, well, hey, we're walking around with the communicators from Star Trek in our pockets, but it's not that far off when you realize that, you know, one, they kind of go hand in hand. People are inspired by fiction, and fiction is inspired by what we can see happening in the future. That just, it also makes me a little bit worried that at some point, you know, maybe people stop imagining the future anymore because they don't know how far it can go, and they don't want to risk writing something that will be timed out after a while.
Yeah, there was some, I forget who said it, there was someone who said everything that can be imagined or invented, and this was like a century ago, already has been. There's going to be nothing new. So, of course, he turned out to be spectacularly wrong, and I also believe that there'll be no limit. My favorite quotation is from Thomas Edison, who said, "We don't know 0.001% about anything."
I like that. And I think it's probably just about factually correct. Yeah. Well, we're going to take a break now. When we come back on the other side, we'll wrap things up with our final segment with our guest, Robert W. Bly. If you have any questions, you can submit them via the wormhole at midnightinthedesert.com. Or if for some reason you're not a time traveler, and I don't know why you wouldn't be, you can send them to me via email, tim@midnightinthedesert.com. We'll get into some of those questions as well. I also want to talk about some of the other work that Robert Bly has worked on, including I want to find out about the Electrical Wizard of Schenectady. And so we'll talk about that coming up, and plus whatever else pops into the discussion. And also, as I said earlier, we're going to have some fantastic discussions throughout the course of the week. Tomorrow night, we're going to be attacking the idea of extraterrestrials, but with a paranormal twist. We're going to be talking with somebody who is a paranormal lightning rod, and he'll discuss his lifetime of paranormal experiences, including angels, demons, ghosts, cryptids, telepathy, telekinesis, mediumship, and contact with aliens. How does that all tie together? As much as we're talking about science fiction tonight, that won't be science fiction tomorrow. That will be a true story. So tune in for that. We'll be back with more Midnight in the Desert coming up in just a few moments. Welcome back to Midnight in the Desert, our final segment with our guest, Robert W. Bly. And again, if you want to find out any more about his work, about some of his books, where you can pick them up, all you have to do is go to midnightinthedesert.com. But don't forget, not only is midnightinthedesert.com the place to go to get everything about the show, but you have to follow us across social media as well. Like us on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter at MITD_show. Help us out by liking and sharing and retweeting and all of that good stuff, so that not only will you see our stuff more often, but also some of your friends will see it as well. And as we were talking about with Robert Bly earlier, you know, these aren't the days when you have to walk up to the book counter embarrassed about the books that you're buying and not wanting the clerk to see that you're buying a superhero story or a science fiction story or any of that. All this stuff is out in the open now, and the weirder the better, and you can share it with all of your friends and let them come and hang out with us, and we can all be a bunch of weirdos together. Let's get right back into our discussion now with Robert Bly. We were talking beforehand about some of the advances that were made in science over the years and how some of them can tie into science fiction. You've actually you've written a book about kind of a somewhat forgotten figure in the world of science.
Yes, the book I wrote is a biography of a man named Charles Proteus Steinmetz, who worked in the late 1800s and early 1900s. And the reason, and he was, if you're an engineer, you could argue that of the people who developed electricity, the U.S. electrical grid, he is the one who did the most significant and essential work, and yet at the same time is the one that no one remembers. And what prompted me to write this book is, you know, I go into a Barnes & Noble, and every time I went, there's two new biographies of Tesla and two new biographies of Edison, and they credit them as, you know, the sole inventors, practically, of the technology on which the electrical grid is based. And I said, then I checked. I knew Steinmetz from my studies, and I checked, and there's no new books about Steinmetz. The last one had been written 25 or 30 years ago, and he's all but forgotten today, yet he arguably did more important work on electricity than either Tesla or Edison when it comes to, again, developing the modern electric grid. And his personal story was, although both Edison and Tesla were very interesting characters, his personal story was equally interesting and perhaps more dramatic. So I said, it's not fair. And I asked my publisher, and they agreed, and we did last year a Steinmetz biography called Charles Proteus Steinmetz, The Electrical Wizard of Schenectady.
Well, I mean, we know that the interest in Tesla has only been reinvigorated over the last, I don't know, maybe 20, 25 years. But before that, it was hard to find things about him as well. You know, Edison dominated the conversation. Why is it that Steinmetz was cast aside and forgotten?
When I wrote the book, I looked into this, and actually, there's no reason. It's sort of luck of the draw. Someone once asked George Peppard, boy, how did you get the, you know, you must be a great actor to get, you know, on the A-team. He says, there's 1,000 actors that I could do what I'm doing. Luck of the draw. Steinmetz was very well publicized when he was living in the 80s and 90s when he was doing work. He was in the newspapers frequently. But after he passed away, for reasons unknown, he became not totally forgotten, but nearly forgotten.
And he had some physical disabilities too, as well, during his life.
Well, he had many unusual and interesting things in his life. Physically, to begin with, he was a dwarf. He was only 4 feet tall, which was difficult for a man a woman too. He was hunchbacked from a spinal curvature, which made it more difficult. He had a leg condition that caused him to walk awkwardly. The socket of one of his legs wasn't placed firmly in the hollow of the pelvis where it's supposed to be, and it was not correctable. And so he walked back and forth with an odd gait. And he had an oversized head. I mean, not freakishly, but, you know, you should look at pictures. You know, his head is large, especially compared to his tiny or small body, and he was rather spindly. So he had a number of physical, you could say, defects or deformities, which dramatized his life, because he wanted more than anything else, more than science, although that was his love. He wanted a family. He wanted children. But he had the same characteristics that his father had. Father passed everything on to him, and he didn't want to risk passing that on to a child. So he never got married, never had kids, and yet, in an interesting way, I tell in the book, and happy to tell briefly now, he ended up with a family and children. That were his adoptive children.
And it's interesting that you say that, you know, he was in the conversation during his time, you know, because I would look at it and say, well, maybe somebody that suffered from his afflictions, as much as that might be a human interest story for a lot of people, you're dealing with, you know, the supposed genius of Edison. You're dealing with the good looks of Tesla, who I think, you know, was a draw for a lot of people for that regard. And you're putting this character up against him, I could see how that would be something maybe in his own time where he would get buried a little bit. But to be famous then, or at least notable then, and then to fall through the sands of time, that just seems very strange.
Well, during the time he was alive, unlike the other two, Tesla and Edison, he did not have his own company, Steinmetz. He worked as the chief engineer for General Electric, and they had major corporation. They had a huge, big PR department, public relations group, and that really publicized him because it bestowed prestige on General Electric and their R&D and technologies. So that's what kept him in the papers then. But as soon as he passed away, you know, GE basically said, you know, we're not going to spend more money on this. He's gone.
Hmm. And did I read correctly here online that he was the first person to create lightning in a laboratory?
He was, as far as we know, the first person to generate artificial lightning of any significance. I mean, real power. I don't have the statistics or the numbers in front of me, but enough. What he his ba- the first time he demonstrated it, the lightning machine was on the ceiling of his lab, and he actually built, because he had an eye, he had a feel for showmanship and publicity. He built a miniature village under it out of wood, like you'd build for a model train. And then when the press came to the press conference, he dimmed the lights in the room, threw a switch, and lightning bolts with a crack came down from the ceiling and hit the town and just decimated it. So yeah, he's the first one who generated very strong lightning bolts.
Well, I mean, it's amazing that I've never heard of this person beforehand, and to now learn about him. I mean, I'm definitely going to pick up a copy of the book, and I think a lot of the listeners will as well. But now that this is out there, I mean, how can you continue pushing and keeping him in the conversation along with Edison and Tesla when they've become so dominant over the years?
He'll probably never rise again to his old level of fame and notoriety. The best I can do is I wrote the book, and I'm going to put up although other things have stopped me from doing it, I'm going to put up a Steinmetz website that I would drive traffic to. He's not completely forgotten. General Electric still has a lot of Steinmetz materials on their site, but you know, they don't promote it. You know, it's a sidebar to their products and technology and sales. So yes, unfortunately, I don't think I'm going to make him famous again. And he should be. He should be as well known as Tesla and Edison. I wrote this book to try to correct that. I won't, you know, totally fix it. But if I can do a little and get a few more people to learn about him and be aware of him, he deserves a lot of kudos that he doesn't get now.
Well, I mean, unfortunately, no billionaire is going to start a company called Steinmetz either. So,
well, he had a company that he had did separately from General Electric. That he had a couple of Steinmetz companies. Of course, he wasn't a billionaire. In fact, he was not wealthy. And he did a company that actually, before Tesla, developed electric trucks.
Oh, well, is this right, this number that I'm seeing, that he had over 200 patents?
He had over 200 patents. Edison had more, by the way. And I can't remember Tesla's number, but it's probably in the same range. Some of them his were very minor. Like, for a while he worked, and it sounds silly, in the hat making business, and like 10 of the patents were for machinery to make hats, but other ones were very significant for electrical equipment, rectifiers, generators, wiring systems, and so on.
Well, I mean, the other thing too is, you said, you know, Edison had more patents, but we can't forget that Edison patented a lot of things that were created by the people that worked under him. So, I mean, it might all be
absolutely true. Watch. And Steinmetz had a lot of people working under him, but he was the innovator. They liked him, and they were smart, but he did all the innovating, and then they did, you know, helped him with the labor to create and build and test these machines.
Well, I think that's a fascinating piece of history that I can already see the listeners are jumping all over. So I would expect to see a little bit of a spike in sales in that book for sure. And hopefully a spike in the notoriety for Steinmetz as well.
Yeah, that's why I wrote it, because really, although I'm interested in it, the main thing is I felt that he deserves more. And if I could do my bit, I'd feel better. He's, to me, actually the most neglected and forgotten significant scientist, although he was a scientist and a mathematician, but primarily an engineer. And, you know, he's probably the most neglected today, and it doesn't make sense, but he is.
And a lot of these real-life scientists who, you know, created these different technologies that got us to where we are today, I'm sure a lot of them worked as inspiration for a lot of the science fiction stories.
Well, that has always been the case, and it's been written. James Gunn has written that in his books about science fiction. Isaac Asimov has written about it. In fact, there was an article, I can't recall where it appeared, that said one of the things that created more scientists than anything else was chemistry sets for kids. But boys would buy Gilbert chemistry sets, and a lot of those who had them would go on to become scientists because of that. I actually became a chemical engineer because I loved chemistry from having a Gilbert chemistry set that I built up in my parents' basement into a small home laboratory.
So did you blow anything up?
I did some bad things.
That's why we really wanted them, was to blow things up.
Well, we wanted to blow things up or do dangerous things or make noxious things. I distilled wood once, and the odor was horrible, and I got in a lot of trouble, but I thought it was interesting.
I think the worst thing that I ever did in a laboratory, and it was not good, but I spilled mercury, which was both terrifying and fascinating at the same time.
Yeah, mercury's dangerous. Now, my mother, who's a smart person, for some reason, and it was a bad choice, she let me buy a bottle of sulfuric acid, and I could have really hurt myself. One drop spilled on my skin, and it turned immediately black. So, yeah, that mercury is even worse because it poisons you.
Right, but it is kind of cool to see the liquid pour out of the...
Oh, yeah.
And then have it turn into little tiny BBs and bounce all over the floor.
The only other metal that I think you can make safely liquid is lead. So lead is also poisonous. But I used to, as part of it, I would melt lead in an iron, small iron pot over my mother's kitchen. And Steinmetz loved to entertain his children with science. And one thing he did is he would heat up lead and then just pour it into a tub of cold water, and where it would instantly solidify into all kinds of odd and bizarre shapes, and they just loved it.
I remember being in the eighth grade and getting the chance to, do lab experiments for the first time, and all it took was one kid. In those days, it was the early 90s, everybody wore these winter jackets called triple fat gooses, and we weren't allowed to wear jackets in class, but this kid had a jacket on, and he had it on, and he turned on the Bunsen burner, and he caught the jacket on fire.
Oh, my God.
And that was when I realized, okay, they're not kidding around when they tell you that you have to be careful around this lab equipment, because, now this kid just burned his brand new $200 jacket that he shouldn't have been wearing anyway. But that kind of instilled in me the need to pay very close attention when doing the lab experiments in science.
Well, that's why both Gilbert and Porter, which was the other big maker of chemistry sets, that business is basically gone. There are a few microchemistry sets they use from ChemCraft and whatever that use small amounts of chemicals, but the ones that were simulated a real lab were gone because of the liability issue. If something happened to a kid, the lawsuit would be unbearable. In fact, it was either Gilbert or Porter not only had chemistry sets, they had other things, and one of them was a radiation set, which actually came with a piece of uranium.
Oh, jeez. I can imagine, that wouldn't go over so well today.
Yeah, and you think about it, people already knew about Adam's moms. Mom wasn't too smart to let Junior get that either.
I had this is how I got interested in radio. When I was a kid, I had one of those electrical kits you could buy from Radio Shack, and one of the things you could do is make a crystal radio out of it.
And I had the same thing. I loved it.
And to me, it was great because I made an actual radio station that you could pick up through my grandparents' old neighborhood. And I remember, my dad gave it to me, and my mom said, should he really be playing with electricity like that? And my dad said, it's only got a couple of D batteries in it. How much could he really shock himself?
How much did you shock yourself?
Not too much, actually, surprisingly. But I've always had a lifelong fear of electricity, so.
I've always had a fascination with it, which is probably unhealthy. One of my favorite activities is if it's an evening and I'm out in the country and there's a huge lightning storm with inter and intra-cloud lightning, as once happened in, when we were, I was out in the Amish country. I could just watch it for hours. It just fascinates me.
I'm not totally crippling fear of electricity. I have a healthy respect for it. But for the longest time, when I was younger, I was caught in an electrical storm while I was camping. And it terrified me so badly that every time there was going to be a thunderstorm, even if I heard one predicted on the news, I would like hide inside my house and I would find like an interior room with no windows and I'd have to stay in there till the storm passed. Now I'm the complete opposite. Now I love storms and I can't get enough of them and I love going out and watching them. But for a long time, it was a bad fear, but I've overcome it over the years.
Yeah, I'm glad you've overcome it because, you know, storm watching is to me one of the most fascinating activities. And the one thing I've never seen, although I've passed through an area where it had happened recently, I've actually never seen a tornado. And of course, to see one would be bad because they can move fast and catch you. But still, the idea of that is fascinating.
I've never seen a tornado, but I have had the opposite of a tornado, a microburst, which
we've had microbursts.
Oh, the first time I ever experienced that. It was a bad storm, and I do this show from my home office. And right outside my home office window, there was a tree. And the microburst hit right over that tree and split it right in half. And it was the most insane sound I've ever heard. And when I went outside to see what had happened, I thought it was lightning. And it couldn't have been lightning because if it was, there would have been a scorching. And
right. There
was no sign of any scorching at all. So I called the National Weather Service and I said, do you have any idea what could have happened? And they said, that's where the microburst touched down. Oh, good. Right in my yard, right by my window. Thanks.
We never had it in our house, but we had a microburst at the end of our block in the street going the other way. And because the people told us and it was on the TV. And when I went down there, there were several houses. Their trees looked like they were shredded in pencil sharpener.
Ooh, geez. Yeah, I live right by the Cape Cod Canal, so we get a lot of the water spouts that would be tornadoes if they were on land.
Right.
And every time there's a bad storm and we get videos of those, you know, because I work for a news station, every time those start rolling in, I'm just fascinated by that, by the fact that if it just had enough power, by the time it hit land, it would have turned into a tornado and who knows what would have happened. But thankfully, it just stays over the canal.
That's lucky because I mean, lots of nature forces are destructive, but the two most are tornadoes and then floods, water. Nothing stronger than a flood.
Yeah, that's glad I live on a hill, at least for that reason alone. But that's kind of the stuff that's it's fruitful for a lot of stories as well, is knowing that, you know, as much as we can become masters of science and as much as we think that we can control the physical world, we're always going to be at the mercy of nature because it's always going to be more powerful than we are.
Absolutely. And, you know, weather control was, you know, technology for controlling weather was predicted by science fiction, but, you know, is in nascent stages in different areas. You know, one of them is simply cloud seeding, but there are other electronic systems that are being researched by the U.S. government that I don't think they work yet, or if they do, I don't know, but that are made to mitigate or control weather.
Yeah, someday we might be able to have more of a handle on it than we do, but I don't know if we want to get to that point. You know, then you're really starting to get into the ethical questions of.
Well, if the wrong guy gets it also.
True. But even just, you know, being able to alter things to that point, like now are we playing too much with the natural world and will there be blowback for doing so?
Right. For example, if we used it to put rain in a parched area of agriculture, would that process remove rain from another area and make it a dry desert? That's the kind of story that J.G. Ballard used to write.
And pondering these things, you know, not only do they lead to just good storytelling, but it, as we said before, it leads to a morality lesson. In a way, it's kind of it'll give you the should you do it before you even ponder the could you do it.
Exactly. I agree with that.
And I think, too, as we go along, and I don't know, I think science fiction has always kind of been reflective of the times anyway. But I think as we go along and we see the different things that divide our culture now, and we see the different things that unite our culture now, like we might be in a place where we're going to get some very dark science fiction coming forward, but we might also get some very enlightening science fiction as well.
Yeah, and there's always been both. But, you know, the other day when I was watching the news and they gave the latest coronavirus update, and I immediately thought, The Stand, but it's worse. So, you know, one relates to the other.
I mean, we talked about the coronavirus a few weeks ago, you know, and I couldn't talk about it without making the Captain Trips reference that, you know, these stories, these science fiction stories, these fantasy stories, they become so embedded in our minds that they become our reference point.
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, there have been multiple science fiction plague stories and, you know, post-apocalyptic stories, which is the kind of genre that I happen to like. And, but you do worry. You think about, you watch the news and say, well, what if we can't stop the coronavirus? Not a pleasant thought.
Brett, we actually live in a world where there are people right now, probably listening to this show, who are preparing for a zombie apocalypse in full seriousness. They actually expect that at some point, you know, the dead will come back to life and take over this world. And that's I guess, the best and the worst of science fiction, when it can be so plausible that it becomes a reality for people.
Right, and I think there was actually, I mean, there's been so many zombie movies, it's no wonder people actually start to think that way. But I think there was a satire, a nonfiction book by a guy named Max something, you know, how to prepare for the zombie apocalypse. And it was written as like a serious how-to manual.
Well, I know a few people that probably have that on their bookshelf and think that it is a serious how-to manual.
Yeah, there might be a business for somebody in putting up a website and selling anti-zombie equipment and products, but I'm not going to do that.
Well, the idea is out there. If anybody does follow up on that, they can cut you in too.
Okay.
That'd be the nice way to do it. All right. Well, thank you so much, Bob, for joining us tonight. This has been a great discussion. I really enjoy getting into some of the mindset of people who create and what it is that helps them to create. So I think this was really eye-opening for a lot of people tonight.
Well, this was extremely enjoyable, and I thank you for having me on the show.
And hopefully we can do it again sometime. I can see, is there a Freak Show of the Gods 2 coming out, or is another volume of stories?
No, well, what I have coming out next is a book in May called The Science Fictionary, which is a dictionary of science fiction, fantasy, and horror terms. And again, that'll be out early May.
Excellent. All right. Well, we will hopefully talk to you again then. For everybody out there, thanks to Keith, thanks to Michelle, thanks to Tracy, everybody in the Midnight Society. I'm Tim. Have a good night.
Will we make it till tomorrow? Will the sun shine on you? Midnight in the desert.